as Mark Jones, right?
Right.
My paternal grandmother was a Jones.
Ah, okay. Yeah. Not, Welsh?
Not, yes, not that it's that uncommon a name. But yes, she is Welsh. Her family was Welsh, although they've been here for a long, long time.
Okay. So with your permission, we'll do the recording and get a chance to review it. What we'd like to do is record a professional biography. Maybe we could start with a bit about your background, family, education, growing up. Are you you're from Maine originally?
Well, I'm actually, technically, I was born in Massachusetts. I was the first one on either side, however, born outside of Maine since about 1780. And we moved back to Maine before I was seven. So I went to school in Maine from second grade to midway through junior of high school. Then we moved back to Massachusetts, finished up high school in Massachusetts, went back to Maine to college, started my professional career in Maine. I'm one of four. I have three sisters. I'm third in the birth order, but the only son, and was told at an early age I had by my paternal grandmother Jones that I had an obligation to produce a male heir, since there were, you know, multiple generations of only sons.
Have you fulfilled your duty?
I have. Okay. I have a son who's just graduated from college. I have a degree in economics from Bates College in Maine. I started, probably 5 years after I got out of college, I started an MA economics, combined MA economics MBA program at University of Delaware.
Yeah, let me ask you just a little bit about your family. What did your parents do?
So my dad was a commercial banker. He was a he became a CEO of the largest bank in Maine when I was about 8 or 9 years old. He was basically a CEO from that point until he retired, except for a few years in his 50s. He retired early. He went back to school and got an MBA and became an executive in residence at University of Maine. He's a Horatio Alger kind of figure. Grew up on a chicken farm, in rural Maine, enlisted in the Navy in World War II, was able to go to college on the GI Bill. He and my mom were high school sweethearts, they got engaged just before he was mustered out and married as soon as he was mustered out. They were married when he went to college. My oldest sister was in fact born when my dad was a sophomore. My mom worked full-time teaching school and as a hairdresser while he was in school. We had a very strong family. My folks are both still living. They're 89, almost 89 and almost 90. They've been married for 69 years.
Wow.
They celebrated, they will celebrate in 2 weeks' time.
That's very rare.
Yeah, it's very rare. We moved a lot when I was a kid, though, always in Maine and Massachusetts. I started in Scituate, Mass. Started school in Scituate. Then we moved to a very rural community with less than 100 people. For second and third grade, I went to the next town over for school. You know, it wasn't a one-room schoolhouse, but there was only 15 or 20 kids per grade. Then we moved into the big city, Augusta, which was 10 or 12 miles away, and I was in Augusta school systems from 4th through 11th. And then to the North Shore of Massachusetts, where I went to Gloucester High for half of my junior year and Manchester High for my senior year. So I think up until I got married, I'd never lived anywhere longer than about 6.5 years in one house. My folks were Dad had traveled all over in the Navy. He started out in North Africa and ended up the war in the Pacific. He'd never been out of Maine until he enlisted. But he got a travel bug, and so we were fortunate to be able to see more of the world than they had been able to see as we were, particularly my younger sister and I, who's just a year younger than I. We were able to travel with them across the country and eventually internationally, but Once I became an adult, I went to Europe. But I think my folks really instilled in all of us an interest in learning about other cultures and learning about other parts of the world. And that's been an important theme throughout my life, both professionally and privately. The other thing that I think has influenced that, you know, my dad was very, he viewed his life as a life of great fortune, to be able to provide for his family in the way that a bank president, bank CEO could provide. That was something that was unknown in his family or my mother's family up to that point. Both had been raised in sort of agricultural families, cattle farmers, chicken farmers, truck gardens, those kinds of things. That also, I think, in some ways, informed how they raised us. They wanted us to view the world much more broadly than one would typically be exposed to in rural Maine. I can remember the first time I went to Washington, D.C., gosh, that was something. The first time I went to New York, my father told me not to sunburn the roof of my mouth from doing that. As a kid, I had a great interest in science. Christian Barnhart did the first heart transplant when I was 9 or 10 years old. And I was...
That's 69.
It was 69, so I was 11. Yeah. 10 or 11. Mm-hmm. I was completely enthralled by that. Did a lot of research, found out he went to University of Minnesota Medical School, so I had set my sights.
I thought he was South Africa.
He was, but he went to University of Minnesota Medical School. Hmm. And... from the time I was 10 until I was probably 19 or 20, my ambition was to be a physician. I was very interested in the natural world. I spent most of my free time in my youth exploring the woods and the streams and fields and so forth in Maine. Mm-hmm. I became an ornithologist, participated in the Audubon bird counts when I was a kid. There's only 7 nesting eagles in the state of Maine, and one of them was on a cliff up above our house, and I knew where it was, so they'd always call me and say, can you go put eyes on the eagles? I was also encouraged to earn my own way, so I had jobs from the time I was 10 on. I had a paper route, I mowed lawns, work was always part of life at home. I also participated in athletics and so forth, but by the time I was in 8th grade, the expectation was that I provide all of my own sporting equipment, skiing gear, and so I always was encouraged to work. Mm-hmm. And I always found it actually quite fulfilling. I didn't like collecting on the paper route, but I liked getting up early in the morning and being the only one out in the neighborhood. I had about 70 customers, 75 customers, this is a theme that has run throughout my professional life. It started when I was 10. Every morning I used to time how long it take me to do my paper route. And my goal was always to shorten and shorten and shorten the time. Mm-hmm. And that sort of continuous improvement, maybe you would call it, mm-hmm. is something that has manifested itself many times throughout my professional life.
Did your father's career in banking, did the banking business make any impression on you?
No. Yeah. So, I actually had a bit of a rift with my father. I don't think it's that unusual. When I was in my late teens, I was very resentful of the fact that he moved us from Maine and I had no voice in that. And I was a quiet nerd in high school, and I had just sort of gotten my feet under me through athletics and student government and mm-hmm. various things like that, when he came home one day and said, we're going to move to Gloucester. I had just gotten my driver's license in Maine, which had a younger age, and he wouldn't let me drive in Massachusetts because I was too young to drive in Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. My girlfriend was in Maine, big high school romance, you know. And so there was a period of time through the end of high school and through a good portion of my college career where my primary objective was to demonstrate that I could make my own way, though it took me quite a while to actually do that. So with respect to banking, Dad was a very large, larger-than-life banking figure in Maine. Mm-hmm. And he's, I subsequently learned through a friend's wife who was a Mainer and a banker, that he was known as the Lion of Maine Banking. And it was very important to me not to be in his shadow, to make my own way. So I never really considered going the banking route. Mm-hmm. I, by the time I graduated from college, I wanted to make my own way. I ended up in my, Bates had a new program. I think I was one of the first class to be able to participate in a subsidized internship program. The Ladd family had given the college some money to set up an endowment that would pay summer wages for students who did internships in a professional field. Mm-hmm. And so I was hired the summer after my junior year to work for a food and drug retailer. Scanners were new in those days, and my projects were to use the data that you could generate from a scanner to optimize profitability. We looked at a variety of merchandising.
Inventory control, that kind of
stuff. Less inventory control and more about how do you set up the supermarket. I worked in the supermarkets as an intern. How do you set up the various sections of the supermarket to optimize profitability, to meet the selection needs of the consumer, but also to ensure that the highest margin products were displayed prominently and so forth.
It's kind of a behavioral research.
A little bit, yep. There were certainly behavioral aspects of it, but more it was around, so I had three distinct projects, if I can remember them. One was to optimize the profitability of the cookie, cracker, and snack section. So I did research at a bunch of different stores and developed a planogram for that section of the supermarket to meet these needs of how do you make sure the higher margin products are prominent, but that you maintain enough facings that you can have the selection that will bring customers into the store and so mm-hmm. forth. One project was looking at the combination of advertising and in-store specials to see how you could affect revenue. That was less about margin than it was about pulling people into the store. And candidly, I can't remember what the third one was. Mm-hmm. This was all done pre-computer, though. So I'd get these enormous printouts from the scanners, and then I'd have to go back to my office and crunch all the data on an adding machine, mm-hmm. and ultimately created a report and delivered. That was the penultimate project. Is I delivered these reports to the senior managers at the end of the summer.
Yeah, so that's actually a pretty impressive project for an intern.
Well, you know, I didn't think of it at the time as an impressive project. I was sort of a data wonk, and I was very strong analytically. Mm-hmm. Always have been, and so it just was an opportunity to do something for the summer that might have some relevance post-college. It was a Maine-based firm, and I, after having been pulled out of Maine as a junior in high school, the only thing I knew I wanted to do when I graduated from college was stay in Maine. I didn't have much sense beyond that, and this was one of the best employers in the state of Maine, so...
And this is Hannaford?
That was Hannaford Brothers, yeah. That's right. Which was at the time, the CEO of Hannaford Brothers was a Bates alum, and he was chairman of the board, which I'm sure had meaningful influence on him willing to take a Bates student in. So they at the spring of my senior year, they were recruiting at Bates and Bowdoin and Colby and other places, and they asked me if I was interested. They had an accelerated... I think they called it a marketing management training program, one of these accelerated programs to, and in fact, Jim's successor was a Dartmouth alum. He was president of the firm at the time, and he'd gone through this program. Mm-hmm. And it was quite interesting because they brought a group of us together, and we had a two-day set of interviews with group activities, individual interviews, etc. At the end of which, they offered me a job in their supermarket marketing management training program. But in one of the manifestations of how I was trying to prove that I was independent of my father, I told them I was not going to take it and I was going to be a ski bum. So they, much to my surprise, they asked me to, when I had exercised that particular demon, to, if I was still interested, they were still interested in me. So I spent a winter as a skiing video cameraman and on-air weather and trail reporter. So I got up every morning at the crack of dawn, made it look like it was live, but taped myself giving the weather and trail report. And then I spent all day with 60 pounds of video equipment early in the life of video technology. Mm-hmm. You know, this camera would have been great.
Yeah.
But I had 60 pounds of gear. I never held a video camera in my hands until the interview, but I could take 60 pounds worth of stuff, and it was probably worth $15,000 at the time, any place on the mountain, safely. And that's how I got the job. Mm-hmm. And the other part of that, so I'd ski all day, I'd take video of the events on the mountains and people skiing, and then I'd put together a half-hour show that we'd run continuously, you know, on a closed-circuit TV station for après-ski. Mm-hmm. In that role, I also ended up putting together two pieces that were picked up nationally, which was pretty cool. We had a race where your times were handicapped based on your weight. So the winner was about a 300-pounder, but we had some 600, 700-pound people racing on skis. And that was picked up by one of the network's evening magazine shows. Mm-hmm. And at Winter Carnival, we had a race down the mountain in canoes, which I put together a three-minute piece on, which was also picked up nationally, which was kind of fun. Mm-hmm. So after the season was over, Hanford was in the same cycle as they'd been in the previous year, and they asked me to participate again, and I did. And this time they had decided that they were going to expand this marketing management training program from the supermarket business to the drugstore business. Mm-hmm. So a young man from Dartmouth and I were selected as the first two marketing management interns in the supermarket business. So they offered me the job, 6 months of training, and then they were going to put us in as store managers into problem stores. So I spent 6 months learning how to run a drugstore, during which time I was a brand new pharmacist, and I were the only two in the store late one night, and we were held up at gunpoint, which was quite exciting. And neither of us knew. We'd set up the pharmacy shelves alphabetically by company, but all the scheduled drugs were arbitrary. And he was brand new and I was brand new, and we didn't know where they were. And it was a little uncomfortable, but eventually we got this guy some what he was looking for, and he left the store. We called the police, and they ultimately caught him. But it was a little bit exciting for a 22-year-old to be staring at a revolver with a nut job on the other side of the counter. They then assigned me to a store in Bangor, Maine, as a store manager. And in an interesting move, the previous manager, who was a pharmacist, was kept on in the store as one of the three pharmacists, mm-hmm. Which was a bit challenging for a young guy to be the manager of the previous manager and the manager of people who had reported to this other guy for a number of years. He was very good about it, but I think it was indicative of the fact that the guy who ran the drugstore division really didn't like this marketing management training program. I don't think they overtly tried to make Brian and I fail, but they certainly made life difficult for us. The big issue on that store was the gross margins were half of what they were supposed to be. It was one of the largest volume stores of the 30, but gross margins were half. And it was very clear that was my job, was to figure out what was going on. Was it pilferage? Was it pricing problems, et cetera? And over around 18 or 24 months, I found all the problems and fixed them, and we got the gross margins up to where they needed to be. And I learned a couple of things. I learned, number one, I spent most of my time in the pharmacy counter asking the pharmacist whenever they had a break, how come we're selling so much of metoprolol or Lopressor? How much are we why are we selling so much of this? What's it for? And that was really the part of the work that I enjoyed. The other thing, I managed 22 or 3 people, some full-time, some part-time, including these two and a half, pharmacists, who were much older than I, made a lot more money than I made, I made a lot of mistakes managing these people. It was very clear. I'd made the classic mistake of treating them the way I wanted to be treated instead of treating them the way they wanted to be treated. At that time, I also, in Bangor, reconnected with a friend I'd had in college, a woman, who, as I said, we had been friends, but never an item, if you will. But in Bangor, we became an item, and we got engaged very quickly. And just before we were due to get married, she was transferred from Bangor to Portland, which was a much nicer place for 25-year-olds to live, 24-year-olds. And B, she had a much better job than I did financially. She was an oil buyer for one of the big local gas companies. And so I told Hannaford that I was going to be moving to Boston, to Portland rather, with my wife. And they offered me a store in the Portland area, but I had pretty much figured out at this point that retail was not my shtick. And in fact, what I wanted to do was to run my own business. So I figured I knew how to manage people. I'd made enough mistakes that I was starting to figure it out. I knew how to manage a P&L. And my father was in a position to be able to support me financially. So he said, look, you find the business, do the diligence, and if I agree with you, I'll support you. So I spent the first 6 months after we were married, unemployed, looking for a business to buy, and was literally a day late and a dollar short in a nursery business. I'd always liked the outdoors, and my father had been a gardener. We'd always had big gardens. My grandfathers had always had big gardens. I'd always spent my summers helping them in the gardens and so forth. But we made an offer on the Friday after Thanksgiving, and on Wednesday they had accepted an offer for this business. So, you know, I'm at this point 5 or 6 months into marriage. I don't have any income, and figured it's time that I contributed something more than doing the cooking, the marketing, and the cleaning. So I started to look for other jobs, and one of the pharmaceutical representatives that called on us in the drugstore in Bangor heard that I was looking, and that company he worked for, which was Stewart Pharmaceuticals, had a bounty program, as many companies did, where if you recommended someone to the firm and they were hired, you as the recommender got a couple $100. So Marty recommended, he called me and he said, we have an opening in southern Maine and southern New Hampshire where you live. I think you'd be good at this. What do you think? Well, I frankly had this vision of sales that was informed by the old, by Herb Tarlick on the old WKRP in Cincinnati, or the Fuller Brush Man, where, you know, yeah, integrity's not part of the deal and it's fast talkers and so forth. But I was relatively desperate at this point, so I said, what the heck, I'll take the interview. First interview, I really liked the young man who was interviewing me. And between first and seconds, they gave us a study guide. The big drug for Stewart Pharmaceuticals at that time was a beta blocker called Tenormin, Atenolol. And so they gave us a study guide where we had to learn cardiovascular physiology, the pharmacology of beta blockers, plus what they were competing with. And if you were invited back for a second interview, you were tested, and if you didn't do very well on the test, you were done. Mm-hmm. Well, I'd taken all kinds of biology and chemistry when I started college as a pre-med. I loved it. This was no issue to learn all this material. I liked the people. There was multiple people in the second round. I liked them very much, and they offered me a job. I'd had a couple of irons in the fire, but the people is what really, combination of the people who were really different than my supervisors in the retail chain, and the material convinced me that I should take this job. So I said yes, and I almost didn't get that job though, because between saying yes and starting, so they had me start based on a training class date, and in part of the process I filled out a form, and I had injured my back in retail. I'd never lost any time from work, and I didn't really understand workers' comp. But I had injured my back quite badly and had to go through a rehab program. Again, I never lost any time at work, but I had done this, and I acknowledged that in the forms. And so the day before I was due to get on a plane and fly to New Jersey and start, I think it was actually a Friday, and I was supposed to leave on Monday morning, I got a call and was told, the medical department is suggesting you're high risk, and we are contemplating rescinding your offer. So I had a lot of conversations with my wife and with my dad, And I had decided that I was going to, on my own nickel, I was going to fly to New Jersey and say, I'd like to start the training program at my risk, because I would like to have this job. And I'm quite certain that upon investigation, the medical folks will figure this out. Well, that was all set up, ready to go. And then Sunday afternoon playing basketball, I broke my hand. So I held off. I did not get on an airplane Monday morning. And they did work it all out, and so I started 3 weeks later. We had at that in those days a prescription business driven largely by Tenorman. That was the biggest product. But we also sold Nolvidex, which was a drug for breast cancer, tamoxifen. We had a surgical scrub business that we sold into hospitals. And we had an over-the-counter business of Mylanta, GI kinds of products. And this was 1984, and the reps handled everything. So we had a specialized sales force that called on academic medical centers, which I had none of. But I had, 10 or 15 hospitals and a number of primary care docs and specialists and so forth. And the combination, I think, of my interest in the science and the fact that I knew how retail operated resulted in very strong performance, and the fact that the territory had been vacant for a time because they had promoted my predecessor into one of these hospital rep jobs in Boston meant that I showed very strong results very, very quickly. My district manager was a terrific, terrific guy, Mike Arecchia, who was very development-oriented. He held us to high standards in terms of our results, though in those days we couldn't really look at results. We didn't. DDD came in, which actually started allowing us to see data at the territory level while I was a rep. But he could tell that things were working, and he got me some exposure, and I did some training down in New Jersey for the regional office. And so I was in that job about 18 months, and they asked me to move to Wilmington, to the U.S. headquarters.
Delaware.
Yeah. To become a sales training instructor. So my wife and I talked about it. It's clear I like this very much, and that if I was going to stay in pharmaceuticals, I would likely have to be willing to move. She had a terrific job, but wasn't a perfect job, and so she decided to go back to school and get an accounting degree and become a CPA, which she did while I went off to Wilmington. And she did one of these quick programs, got an associate's degree, but passed the accounting exam on the first go-round.
And she wanted to be independent? Is that
she wanted to be independent, and she wanted to have a job that was interesting and mobile and reasonably remunerative. Mm-hmm. And she was a math major at Bates, so she'd done some accounting in her job at the oil company. Mm-hmm. So it was an obvious step for her at the time. So I moved to Delaware, and Stewart Pharmaceuticals at that time was a division. It was the U.S. pharmaceutical arm of ICI, and ICI was a big British-based chemical company. I think, this is the early 80s, I think our market cap at the time was in the $25 to $30 billion range. We had 120,000 employees worldwide, not in the pharmaceuticals business alone, but in the total ICI. Mm-hmm. And we had U.S. headquarters in Wilmington. So pharma was a piece of a very large entity down there. Mm-hmm. And so I became a trainer, where my primary objective was to teach selling skills to newly hired reps. But each trainer also had a therapeutic area that they were supposed to be the expert in. And as the new trainer, I got the GI franchise, which wasn't very interesting. And after about 6 or 8 months, I went to the boss and said, I'd like something more technically challenging. And so they expanded my portfolio. We were growing very rapidly at the time. And one of the things that we did in the 18 months I was in that role is we trained the first Stewart Pharmaceuticals antibiotic sales force. So we had a phase, a second generation cephalosporin, Cefotetan was the brand name, that was nearing the end of development. Mm-hmm. And this was going to be an adjunct to our hospital scrub business. And so while I'd never sold an antibiotic at that point, I was tasked with building the training program for the 250, 300 salespeople we needed to train, and actually conducting the train the trainer and then train the rep courses, which was really my first exposure to microbiology. That all went off well. We launched the drug. It did okay. It didn't do great. About the same time, we were expanding our total sales footprint, which required more district managers, and so I was approached about... Stuart in those days didn't really... You had an interview process, but you weren't really offered a job. You were told what your next job was. So my next job was to go to Minnesota, to Minneapolis, and be the district manager. And we were splitting our sales forces, so we had mirrored sales forces. I was in a new division called ICI Pharma, which was the... to Norman, it was a cardiovascular portfolio and the oncology portfolio, and Stuart Pharmaceuticals was this new antibiotic and surgical scrub, etc. Because we were undergoing this split and this expansion, of my 11 original sales reps, 5 were brand new. They were hired by my predecessor. Mm-hmm. So I got 5 experienced, or 6, I think it was 6 experienced and 5 new ones. And I'm sure that part of the reason I went there is because I was a good trainer and I had a bunch of new people in this district. And part of it was because I was from Maine and they figured I wouldn't run away the first winter in Minneapolis. Our daughter had been born about 2 months before they told me what my new assignment was. So I went off to Minnesota, bought a house. Allison and Aaron came out 4 or 5 weeks later after they'd sold the house in Delaware. And I took over this district. Well, what I found out when I got there was it was the top performing district in the country. And it was made very clear to me by my boss that it better continue to be the top performing district in the country. So it, geographically, I had western Wisconsin, all of Minnesota, north and south Dakota.
Well, this is a new situation in the sense that it's already here. And it's
right.
Taking it, that's a real challenge, not
right.
only to maintain it, but yeah.
Right. So I did that job for about 3 years, and one of the wonderful, first of all, it was my first management job after being a store manager. So all the mistakes I'd made as a store manager, I was able to integrate and change as I took on this new district, half of the people were older and much more experienced than I, and half were brand new. But the other thing that was going on at the time in Minneapolis in particular, but across Minnesota, was managed care. This was the late 80s. And the industry hadn't created dedicated sales organizations. So as a district manager, if my business was going to continue, I had to figure out how to work with managed care organizations. So I used to call on the pharmacy directors of United Healthcare and all of these things. And it was a wonderful opportunity to learn a model that at that time existed really only in California, Minnesota, and Massachusetts, but became ubiquitous 10 years later, 5 years later. So I did maintain our top rating. We launched an ACE inhibitor while I was a district manager and a LHRH analog for prostate cancer. A couple of my people got promoted, the new group that I had, and the company ran a couple of times a year. They'd bring in a handful of people and run them through an interview process broadly across the commercial internal operation in Wilmington. So I was asked to participate in one of those and was offered my next assignment, which was back in Wilmington, and it was in the new product planning department. So in one of these surveys they had sent around interest, I had marked market research, given my experience at Hannaford Brothers, as something I had experience in and was interested in. And not many salespeople would do that. And that, I think, was a flag for them. So I went to work in the new product planning department, which essentially had two roles. One was to be the commercial representatives on the various therapeutic area teams, the development programs. Mm-hmm. And the second was to support the business development activity. Be the analytical underpinning, if you will, for whatever deals we wanted to do. And I was assigned the half of the antibiotic portfolio, the full CNS portfolio. We had no CNS drugs at that point, but we had an early stage schizophrenia drug, which became Seroquel, that I attended to. Plus, we had a bunch of research programs going on in depression and other area, other CNS diseases. And I got part of the inflammation and immunology portfolio. And most of our focus in those days was on asthma. Worked for a couple of... I probably learned more in that job and one other job at Zeneca than I've learned in any jobs I had. I worked for a couple of very experienced marketing guys who were great fun, but also just sort of knew the business and knew how to navigate a big, complex international organization, and they were wonderful mentors.
Yeah, so when you say you learned more in that position, what's coming to mind, the particular lessons?
I learned about drug development. You know, I'd been at the customer interface after things had been approved, but I didn't really understand all the steps you had to go through to get something approved. But I sure did, sitting on all of those development team meetings in those sort of parts of three therapeutic areas. We also were undergoing a review. We had seven therapeutic area teams at that time. Did we want to keep all seven? Should we focus? Should we expand, et cetera? So a lot of work around what are the opportunities, where's the science going, et cetera. And we got to be, again, involved in business development, which was a very high, for a young, relatively junior person, gave us a lot of senior exposure. So I'd present to the head of sales and marketing, I'd present to the U.S. president, et cetera, on these business development opportunities. And one of the BD opportunities that I was asked to lead the analytical work on was another antibiotic that was being developed by Abbott. This is a quinolone, an IV and oral quinolone called temafloxacin. And we ended up doing a deal with Abbott to co-launch temafloxacin, both primary care and hospital. And along the way, I'd become the first international, non-UK-based international marketing manager for the CNS portfolio, which I was real. I was very terrible disease. I'd lost a high school friend from schizophrenia. So I actually started, there was a wonderful woman doc, Lisa Arvanitis, who was a psychologist, board-certified psychology and neurology, who was leading this development program. She was incredibly generous with her time, and I used to just pick her brain about what happens here, what shows up clinically, what's going on in the brain, etc. And so I learned a lot about it, and I was very passionate about Seroquel. This was a drug, hadn't named it yet, I can't remember its generic name, but this drug looked like, in the early phase 2 studies, it was going to be able to really help these patients and not have the liabilities that some of the previous anti-schizophrenia drugs had. And as a result, they asked me to be this international marketing manager, first time ever outside of the UK, which meant I was now going to the major affiliates, France, Germany, Japan, learning about schizophrenia in their markets and how do we need to develop this drug so it's successful not just in the US but around the world, which was pretty heady stuff for a little kid from Maine who was still in his 20s. And so, but I was also doing this analytical work on the temafloxacin deal. So we did the deal. It was very important for the company that we launched this thing successfully. And my boss came to me one evening and said, the senior commercial guy is going to offer you in the next few days, he's going to offer you the job as product manager for us, for temafloxacin. And I said, well, I don't want it. I want to be the international marketing manager for Seroquel. And he said, I know. But I want you to understand, Mike, that Jack thinks he's offering you the best commercial job we have available right now. And you just need to think about, you need to make your own decision, but you need to think about how he would react if you say no to this. I felt it was very unfair that that was the orientation, but I was very appreciative of Tom that he actually mm-hmm. would share this perspective with me. So it was over a weekend, I thought about it, and Jack offered me the job, and I said, I'll do it.
Did you feel like there was any way to have a conversation with him about it?
It was not part of the culture to have that conversation with him. Mm-hmm. Though, we'll fast forward in a few minutes, a couple of years, and in a similar kind of circumstance, I did feel confident by that point. One of the things they had done was, as I was a new product planner, I didn't think that my portfolio was a full-time job. So I always used to go to my boss and say, I'm available if you want me to do projects. And one of the things they'd asked me to do, given my relatively recent history as a DM, was to start building with a very good technical guy a model for assessing Salesforce productivity and trade-offs between products. What's the promotional response to this product versus this product, et cetera, et cetera. And we'd really made some incredibly good work, which shortly thereafter became critical to the company as ICI decided to split and Zeneca was going to become a standalone traded company. We'd always been sort of buried. And that also got me lots of exposure to the senior people, which over time got me more confident that I could say, hey, wait a second, there's some other stuff going on in my life here, or I've thought about my career differently. But at that point, it had not. I did not feel confident that I could do that. So I took the job as a product manager, and it turned out to be a very good decision, not only because of what happened ultimately with Cubist, but because for the first time in my tenure at Zeneca, or ICI, I'd been there at that point probably 5 years, 6 years, something, year and a half, but about 7 years actually.
So this is about 89, 90?
Oh, early 90s probably, 92. Yeah, early 90s. In order for me to do this job, I spent 3 days a week at Abbott Park with the marketing team at Abbott Park preparing for the launch for 9 months. So I saw how another firm operated, and they operated differently than Zeneca. I'm not sure it was better, but it was different. And it sort of broadened my horizons. We launched the drug. We were way ahead of schedule, six months into the launch. And first Friday night, I'd gone home at 5 o'clock in a year and a half probably. And as soon as I got home, my wife said, the head of sales is on the phone. So I got on the phone with Jane, and she said, Mike, there's been a couple of deaths, and you need to come back. We need to figure out what we're doing. So back I went to the office. We spent that all of Friday night and all of Saturday with the senior people, right up to the president of the U.S. He had the CEO from U.K. on the speakerphone. He had the CEO of Abbott on the speakerphone. This was a worldwide deal, but U.S. had launched first. And he was superb. The U.S. president was superb in this circumstance. The data were pretty clear that in rare cases in diabetics that this drug did something to the kidneys that caused people to die. We'd had, I think, two or three deaths at this point reported to the FDA. And it wasn't clear that it wasn't clear whether this could be managed or not. And Bob was incredibly persuasive that the reputation of both companies were, Abbott was building the company on this antibiotic and another one that they were launching similarly, and they were quite resistant to voluntarily withdrawing it. But Bob convinced both them and the CEO in the UK that for the greater good, we needed to pull this off the market. And so by, I don't know, 1 or 2 o'clock Saturday afternoon, everybody had aligned that that's what we needed to do. All the Zeneca ICI senior people were then going off to a national sales meeting. And I was told that my job was to get every tablet and vial out of the market within 3 days. And as they were walking out the door, my direct supervisor said, well, Mike, have a great weekend. And, you know, I don't know what your job's going to be, but there aren't many people in the industry who've launched a drug and pulled a drug off the market at your age, so I'm sure something will come up. And away they went. We did execute it, the plan, and we pulled everything out of the off the market very quickly. And when they got back from the meeting, they said to me, look, there's some wrap-up activities here, that's fine, but we want you to become the product manager for an IV anesthetic that had been launched, Diprovan, propofol, but was about ready to... was at the FDA for a significant label expansion to be used in ICU sedation. Completely different call audience, different use of the drug. We even debated whether we should rebrand the drug for that use. So they said, okay, so you're going to build a marketing team now, and we're going to get ready to launch this drug. meantime, all these extra projects kept coming my way. So I built a team and I built a launch plan for Diprivan for ICU sedation. And while this was going on, the board of ICI had decided to split the company into two. ICI was going to retain the sort of capital-intensive heavy chemical businesses around the world. And Zeneca had been created and had actually been separated out. So we were a separately traded stock with a separate board, et cetera. So we were now Zeneca. And Zeneca was the sort of the high-tech businesses, pharma, ag, and some specialty businesses. And so about 2 weeks before we were launching Diprivan for ICU sedation, the senior commercial people kept stopping by my office saying, you're going to look good as a director, something like that. And so I knew something was up, but I wasn't sure what. So I got a call from the president, which never happened at my level. He said, could you come and see me? Of course. And what had happened was that in the contract to divide the company, Zeneca had committed that they would be off of all of the old ICI legacy accounting systems and everything by a date certain. They had, Zeneca management had twice kicked off the project to make this happen, and it had failed both times. So we now had, it was February, I remember, we had less than 2 years, or, as the way it was characterized to me by Bob, was, we want you to run this project, Mike. You have until, I forget the year it was, but it was February of year one, you have until December 31st of the next year to install a system. But you don't have to just install the system. We've already made the decision we're going to buy SAP, and so you have to figure out how to pay for the project. And I don't know if you can do it by yourself or if you need to build a 400-person team, but the bigger the team, the more you have to re-engineer the business to take the costs out, to pay for the project. And he said, and if you fail, you're going to be fired and I'm going to be fired, so you better not fail. And I said, Bob, look, I'm flattered, but I'm a marketing guy. What the hell? I mean, I can run an Excel spreadsheet. What do I know about technology? He said, we've had consultants up the wazoo, and they said, we don't need a technologist. You have plenty of SAP experts. What we need is someone who's a leader who can make the project work. So he said, you're going to report to me on a dotted line basis. You're going to report the head of manufacturing on a straight line basis because he can intimidate anybody that you need to have intimidated and to get done what you needed to do. And you have basically a blank sheet to build this team and make this work. It was a very high visibility project. And the opportunity to truly have a greenfield. There were six, I think, technical people that we had hired who were experts in the software. And there was Anderson Consulting who we'd hired to advise us on this. So,
and how big was the company?
The company at that time was, the U.S. organization was about 2,400 people and about $1.5 billion of revenue. And so one of the first things we had to do was scope the project. And the project turned into an international scope, though most of my efforts were in the U.S. And we had to coordinate with the ag business and the specialty businesses who had to have the same software implementation. They went about it differently, but we had to implement the same software, and we had to the same timeline. So it was, again, my first exposure to greenfield, and it got me, I used to meet monthly with my counterpart in the ag business and in the specialty businesses. I had to go to Alderley Park, where the CEO of Zeneca was, on a quarterly basis, report to him on what was going on, and I went to U.S. leaders' staff meetings every month and had to give them a report and assignments to all the senior people on what had to happen in their areas. The only part of the value chain that was off limits to me was core discovery research, two-thirds of which was done in UK and one-third of which was done in the U.S., but all development activities, all manufacturing, all accounting, all commercial, all IT, everything. So I built a team of initially, I forget, it was probably about 40 full-time equivalents, which required that I negotiate with every functional senior vice president, and I needed their best people, their most forward-looking people. So there was a lot of arm wrestling on that. But Bob, to his credit, made it very clear that this was not an optional exercise for them. And we structured the project, we structured our work plan, built a big project plan, and I ended up with five teams reporting to me with, I forget, initially there was about 50 people, but at the height there were about 175 people full-time. And by the time we got ready to train, we trained over 700 users. It was the largest SAP implementation in North America at the time. And we came in on budget, and we were able to close the books in January. We were able to implement the software January 1, and we were able to close the books on January 30th. When Bob offered me this job, I didn't really know what he was offering me. But the first thing, when he started talking about, you know, we don't know how big the project is, but you have to figure out a way to save the money and so forth, I said, okay, are you willing to put a hiring freeze on right now? And he did, literally, he sat back in his seat like this, and he said, what are you talking about? I said, I'm not going to be known as the butcher of this project, the butcher of Zeneca. So I think it's critical that you put a hiring freeze on. And he wouldn't commit, to his credit, he wouldn't commit in the moment. But we talked a few times over the course of that week as I met with the consultants and started understanding the project scope and so forth better. And he finally said, okay, we're going to freeze everything but this small group of core roles that if someone leaves, we have to be able to fill. I said, okay, I can live with that. So when we rolled the project publicly, my title was Director of Core Business Systems and Reengineering. And reengineering in that time, everybody knew you were the butcher. I could commit to them that we had put this hiring freeze in place specifically so that we had the opportunity to retrain people whose jobs were eliminated for new jobs at Zeneca. And away we went. That, you know, so in new product planning, I sort of learned about the development process, but now I learned everything. How you buy a clinical trial, how you monitor a clinical trial. Everything was in scope. How you did preventive maintenance in a manufacturing facility.
So this is your conversations with the senior vice presidents?
Yes. And we had to figure out where could we find efficiencies in the process so that we could reduce the cost base to pay for the project. It turned out it was about a 15% reduction in the cost base in order to pay for the project. And I'm very proud to say we were able to accomplish the objective of the project, re-engineer the business, so take 15% of the cost base out. At the end of the day, I think we ended up laying off 11 people out of a 2,500 person workforce. So I think it was successful by all accounts. I can remember the manufacturing guy, because we had this big manufacturing facility in Delaware. It was his responsibility. And he was my day-to-day supervisor. And he's passed away now, unfortunately. But he was a big, tough guy and of Polish descent. And he played... And it became apparent to me after a couple of weeks that he was playing the dumb Polak role. He was smart as a whip. But he came to my office one day as I was scoping out all the project, and he slammed the door and he said, if you cause a union to come into my plant, I am going to kill you. I said, but Bob, if you can't... Eventually, we went back and forth on this a lot. Union never came into the plant, but I come forward with, say, here's a way I think we can save, you know, $2 million a year on manufacturing in this plant. And he'd say, yeah, but it's going to upset everybody, and the union will come in. And I said, Bob, if you can't do anything for fear of a union, maybe we should have a union, right? Because you're operating like they're in control anyway. And if you can't make the changes that we have to make, he said, you have no idea what it's like to run a union plant. I know what it's like to run a union plant. I said, you're right, I don't know. I think we can do this without that threat, and we ultimately made pretty good progress there. Mm-hmm. But it was incredibly educational. I saw, from an operational standpoint, I saw everything. I never coded the equipment, the software, but I was the process design decider, mm-hmm. and these five different teams had business people and technical experts on them, and they'd engage with the business to say, okay, how do we drive more efficiency? Let's not just automate an inefficient process. Let's figure out a new process. And it was everything. It was great. So one of the recommendations we made, at this point, commercially, Zeneca had three distinct nationally managed sales forces. They had a primary care sales force, an oncology sales force, a hospital sales force, actually four, and a national account sales force. Managed care, this was in the early 90s, managed care had spread its wings. We were, it was Hillary Care was being discussed. There was great concern, Merck had bought Medco. There was great concern about the power that the payers were getting. And so we did an in-depth review of how we went to market as part of the project. And I came forward with a recommendation that we consolidate, we change the profile of a regional manager to be a true P&L manager. And we consolidate the four national sales forces into local units so that United Healthcare could deal with one person across the full book of business instead of having to deal with one person for the primary care stuff, a different person for the hospital and so forth. This was very controversial within that firm at that time, largely because of power issues and in part because of the profile of this new regional czar, if you will, was fundamentally different than our regional managers, and there was a lot of debate about whether we even had the manpower to implement this model. It took me about a year to convince the head of commercial and the U.S. head that we needed to go in this direction. But they finally said yes. About 6 months before we would go live, 2 months after that, I was approached again by the U.S. President and said, okay, looks like the project's going to be successful, and I'm not absolving you of this responsibility, and you continue to be the director of core business systems, and you're on the hook for going live January 1. But I also want you to head sales up and make this go-to-market change happen. So go see the head of commercial. So I go to see the head of commercial, and he basically says, this is great, Mike, because this is a way to get you back into commercial and get you retrained on what it's like to be a commercial guy. He basically undermined everything I've been doing for the last 18 months, which didn't leave a great taste in my mouth, but at least we were headed in the direction I thought we should be headed in. So I became head of sales and core business systems director in reengineering at the fall of 94, mm-hmm. with a remit in the sales force to make this change happen, which meant firing a bunch of longtime senior sales guys who had trained all the senior people and creating a new model. I put a woman out of HR in as one of the regional heads, and I put a 29-year-old black man in as who had terrific broad skills into one of the other six regions in the country, and gave him a lot more responsibility and accountability. And December 31st came around. We trained 650 people, whatever it was. January 1st, we were able to actually pay our bills, ship product, generate invoices. The chart of accounts was all set. We were all set to go. January, we could. So the end of January, I was absolved of the core business systems responsibility, just focused on the go-to-market. We were getting ready to launch a whole series of mostly oncology products at the time. And that summer, I decided to take my first two-week vacation ever. We had three children at this point. They were all, let's see, this was 95, so they were 7, 4, and 1. And both families were in New England. My wife's family had retired to Wolfboro, New Hampshire, and Winnipesaukee, and my family was in Portland, Maine. That included most of our siblings, not all of them, but most of our siblings. And so Allison was going to take the kids and come to New England for the summer, and I was going to come up for 2 weeks. And the Friday before I was ready to get on a plane, I got a call from a headhunter, and I'd never taken a call from a headhunter before. But the pitch was basically, there's a biotech company in Boston, It's cash flow break even. They are looking for a VP of sales to bring in and create their commercial infrastructure to launch their first product. Are you interested? I said, well, I had this experience with the head of commercial where he sort of, I don't know what the right word is. It didn't feel to me like he appreciated the experience I had gained in the previous job, and he put me into a role that he thought I would have no problem doing as a way to sort of turn me back into a commercial person, because I'd spent all of almost 2 years outside of the commercial organization.
And you felt that would be confining? You wanted to do...
I thought that it was the way that he operated. So I'd been working for him since they made me head of sales, so it had been maybe 9 months or 8 months at that point. The way he operated was nobody ever got the full picture. We got assignments. And after having had the full picture of the whole company, that didn't sit very well with me. So I was a little more, well, it was the first time I'd ever actually even answered a call. So I said, well, look, I'm headed up this evening for 2 weeks in New England. Sure, I'll have a conversation with him. That turned out to be Biogen. So I went down on Monday, and I had a full day. I'd never seen interviews like this. I had a full day of interviews. I met with the CEO. I met with the head of commercial. I met who actually was really the CFO. Never been a commercial guy in his life. Met with the COO. I met with the medical director. I met with the head of R&D.
It's a much different
kind
of...
Completely different. It was 400 people at the time. You know, I had 1,000 people reporting to me, and this whole organization was 400 people.
Yeah, let me ask. You're with a pharmaceutical company for 10, 11 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, the biotech industry is gaining some momentum during that period. But was that on your radar screen at all, what was going on there?
Not really. Most within Zeneca at that time, there were a small group of people in BD, and I was very close to the head of BD at the time, who was sort of a mentor, who thought biotechnology was actually going to have some impact. The vast majority of people thought it was crazy science experiments. And we really had, we'd come close. I mean, I had done some analysis on a long-acting GCSF, you know, Neupogen. But that was really my only exposure to anything but small molecules at that point. But this headhunter did a nice job. He basically said, it's a greenfield. They don't have anybody in the business who's ever launched a pharmaceutical product before. It's not as risky as many biotech companies, and there's cash flow break even based on a royalty stream. I thought, well, geez, I got three kids. They were born in three different states. All the families in New England. I'm going to be up there anyways. Why don't I just talk to them? So that first day at Biogen, I was very impressed, A, with the lack of, you know, I've been essentially spending the last 2.5 years of my life dealing with silos as I did this re-engineering project. There's no, everybody seemed to be on the same page. I was shocked. No matter who I talked to, they all said the same things about what was critical for the firm and how we needed to get from here to there and what they knew and what they didn't know and so forth and so on. So I left that day actually quite impressed. And I drove back to Maine, and before I actually got back to my folks' house, they called and said, can you come back on Wednesday? So I called them back, and I said, no, I cannot. I committed to my children and my nephews that we would go camping on Tuesday night, and that's a commitment I'm not going to break, but I can do it on Thursday. So they rearranged everybody's schedule, and I came back on Thursday. The other thing that had happened was, there's a great story in here, too. The guy who hired me at Biogen loves to tell the story.
I'd like to hear some of the names of the people who you interviewed with.
So I interviewed with, this first time through, I interviewed with Jim Tobin, who was the COO. Mm-hmm. Ken Bate was the guy who was going to hire me. John Allum, who was the medical director on Avonex. Mark Luchtenberger, who was the director of marketing and the program lead on Avonex. What was his name? He unfortunately died soon after joining the company. Irv Smith, who essentially ran he was head of regulatory, but he was really the development guy. The head chief medical officer was Irving Fox. I interviewed with him. I may not have the whether it was the first day or the second day, but it was all these senior people. Mm-hmm. A bunch of the they had a product manager who was ex Merck. I met with him, Mark Staybach, Lilla Swan, who'd been at Boehringer Ingelheim, was heading up market research. I met with her during this interview process.
Jim Vincent's still the CEO?
Jim Vincent's still the CEO. I met with him at the end of the process. I didn't meet with him in the beginning. I have some Jim stories I can share with you. So I get back and they say, can you come back on Wednesday? No, Thursday would work though. So they rearrange their schedules. I come back on Thursday. Now, I'd been coming up on vacation and at the last minute, you know, I'd thrown in a pair of slacks and a sport coat and a tie. At Zeneca, of course, casual Fridays in the mid-90s was a huge move. And casual meant you took your tie off, but you still wore a suit. So, but I didn't have any clean clothes, and where my folks lived, I didn't have any, we didn't even have a washer and dryer there. So I said, okay, everybody else seemed to be casual on the first day, so I showed up in a pair of khakis and a fishing shirt. And I'd camp, actually, on an island on Wednesday night, Tuesday night and Wednesday night, with my three little kids and two nephews who were roughly the same age and their dad. And in order to get off you had to paddle, canoe, on and off the island. Well, I got up at 4 o'clock on Thursday morning, and it was low tide. So to get off the island, I had to drag a canoe across a couple hundred yards of mud, paddle a short distance, and then drag it across another couple hundred yards of mud. Mm-hmm. I get in the car, my dad's car, I start heading south, and I realize 15 miles down the road I've forgotten my wallet. I can't pay the main tolls. I can't actually get to, I'm supposed to be there at 8:30. But of course, given the way I was raised, I had enough time. I turned around, went back, dragged the canoe over, paddled, dragged the canoe, got my wallet, dragged, paddled, dragged, went to my folks' house and showered and put on a pair of khakis and a clean fishing shirt and showed up on the nose at 8:30 in the morning for this set of interviews. And when I walked in this very casual attire, and Ken Bate, who was the hiring manager, I didn't know it at the time, but he said, I figured this guy has to be confident if he can show up at a second interview in a fishing shirt and a pair of khakis. So I had another terrific day. Again, came away very impressed with the people and with the opportunity and so forth and so on. So, they had been doing this search for some time. Avonex was at the FDA at that point. Their plan was to be launch ready April 1st. This was July. So we had whatever that is, 8 months, 9 months. And as July moved into August, you know, they kept calling me. I made it back here one other time. They flew me back for other meetings. They flew me back in August for a couple of meetings, and they asked me to bring Allison. So this was the check out the spouse meeting. And so I said, I can't really take any time off. So we came up on a Friday, late in the day, and we met Ken and his wife for dinner. And we walked into the restaurant over on Charles Street, and there's Allison's boss sitting at the bar, unbeknownst to us. And we couldn't not say hello, so Allison said, you know, hey, Stacy, how are you? And I said hello to Stacy, and Ken jumped in and said, yeah, we're all college friends. And so we had dinner there and so forth. And then the next morning I had breakfast with the head of manufacturing, Jim Mullen, who, it turns out, graduated from high school with my wife in the same class. And then after I had lunch with, or breakfast with Jim, they drove me out to Jim Vincent's home in Weston, and I spent 4 hours in his basement being interviewed. Mm-hmm. An interview unlike any I have ever experienced previously or since. I mean, we started with what did you do when you were 8, who are your heroes? It went everywhere. And Ken Bate having worked for Jim Vincent for quite some time, had arranged to meet me for lunch as soon as I was done with Jim Vincent to sort of deprogram and...
He knew what it was going to be like.
Yeah. So we met, and he said, well, how'd it go? And I said, well, I have no idea. I've never had an interview like that. And we sort of replayed some of it and so forth. And then I went back to Allison. Allison had done a little, you know, looking around the area, real estate kind of stuff. We flew back to Pennsylvania, and, you know, a couple of weeks went by. And the headhunter kept calling me, but I never heard from Ken. Then the headhunter called me and said, Ken's going to call you, he's going to make you an offer, and here's what the offer is going to be. Are you prepared to accept it? And I said, I'm actually very encouraged by this. This is a greenfield opportunity. I've had one of those. I like the risk-reward aspect of it. That risk-reward meaning a large part of the compensation was going to be equity. I had just begun to get a little bit of equity in Zeneca, but I couldn't really affect Zeneca overall in my role. I mean, it could have some impact, but here I could have major impact. It was in a place in the world where my kids could get to know their relatives, so there were some personal issues associated with this move. And I was quite enthusiastic. And I communicated that to the headhunter, and then Ken called, and he made me the offer. And first he apologized for doing it over the phone. He said, I would much prefer to fly to you, given your schedule and my schedule. And I was putting some pressure on him to make a call because there was a launch meeting coming up that I was hosting for a new product in September. And I said, look, if you don't, I've got to give them a month to replace me. It's just not fair. And so if you're unprepared to make a decision, then you have to give me, I won't be willing to say yes until 3 weeks after this launch meeting. So, which means we're in October now, and I said to him, look, I don't think there's that many people can build you this organization in 6 months. I think I can do it. But if you don't make up your mind pretty damn quick, I'm only going to have 4 months, and I'm telling you, nobody in the world can do it in 4 months. So, so Ken called, and he apologized for doing it over the phone. He made me the offer, and it was different and less than what the headhunter had said. And I reacted, I listened to it, and I said, Ken, I was led to believe this was going to be a very different offer. So I'm a little concerned about whether you guys are aligned and whether you're communicating effectively with your partners and so forth and so on. That's the first major red flag I've had. I'm going to have to think about this a lot. He got on a plane and flew down and took me to dinner that night. And without disclosing inappropriately what was going on, he gave me a very clear idea that he had given up a lot of flesh to get Vincent over the goal line. Jim had asked me, one of the things I've learned subsequently, when I talked to Jim about this period of time that was a gap in my CV when I was looking to buy a business, I said, this is what I'm looking to buy a business. He said, well, tell me about, and I told him what I've told you, which is, I was a day late and a dollar short. He said, tell me about the business. I said, well, it was a nursery business. You know, they had a flower shop. They had shrubbery and a bunch of greenhouses and all this stuff. And he evidently heard that as evidence that I had no real ambition, because this is not what Jim would ever have thought was a successful life.
And you're 22 at that age.
I'm 22, yeah. 23 at that age, right? Well, Ken, I can't remember the sequence, but Ken had asked me about this. I said, well, look, I had met this guy a few years before when I had met my wife's family's friends who ran the largest rose business in the world. And I thought, well, this is a base. It's cash flow positive. It has some land. I could probably, I don't know if it's roses, but I could turn this into something significant. I didn't tell that to Jim. He asked me who my heroes were, and I said, my dad's one of my heroes. The guy who led my Outward Bound course, who, you know, if you were going to be in a plane crash in the Andes, you would want right beside you. He was so competent and calm. And I said, and Thomas Jefferson. And that, of course, Jefferson might have flown with him, but the other two wouldn't fly with Jim. Why would you look to these guys as heroes? Anyway, so he He made me the offer. He explained to me what was going on. It was substantially more than I was making. I was a bit unnerved by the sequence of events, but he, based on his willingness to get on a plane and come and talk to me, convinced me that this was a good move. So I gave my notice the next day. The president called me up. He said, you know, you're sort of the first person we've ever had a conscious, planful program to develop you into a senior leader. And, you know, you could be in my job or something bigger than that if you stayed. And I said, well, that's very flattering, Bob. It would have been great if someone had told me that's what was going on here, number one. Number two, I'm working for a guy who doesn't appear to value those experiences that you just told me were planful experiences. And so I'm not sure how to interpret that, number one. But frankly, the bigger issue is this is a greenfield. You gave me the opportunity to create a team from scratch. I was completely energized by doing that. That's what I'm going to be doing here. He said, is there anything we can offer you the counter? And I said, can you offer me a greenfield opportunity? He said, I don't think I can. I said, that's what's appealing to me, Bob. So we parted friends, and I was right at the edge of my own internally defined timeline, but they were able to have their launch meeting successfully and so forth. And I came up here and started, I forget what it was, mid-September or something like that. And basically was told, okay, build a commercial organization to launch this drug. You've got to be launch ready by April 1st. I knew that coming in. They had a bunch of CVs of people that they'd interviewed for the role I took. So we started there.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you at this point, mm-hmm. you can tell me going forward how you're getting started, but you mentioned risk-reward and looking at this opportunity. How did you assess the technical risk and the market risk for Biogen at this point? I mean, Zeneca is a pretty, you know,
yeah.
And Biogen is...
Well, look, we had about $300 million worth of royalty income a year between the hepatitis B vax, Biogen did, between the hepatitis B vax and interferon alpha from Schering, Klaus, MithKline, mm-hmm. et cetera. And Vincent had managed the business to be about break even. I was very impressed with the leaders of the firm, Vincent, Tobin, Ken, and I was incredibly impressed with, as I said, the alignment in the organization after having spent 2 years fighting internal battles. I was very confident that Avonex was going to get approved. I had some concerns about the IP. I raised them, and they put the GC in front of, they got me in front of the GC, it was Mike Astor at the time, and he sort of took me through the technical aspects. I wasn't an IP expert by any stretch at that time, but he convinced me that they had a solid case to make. Mike's a very persuasive guy. Actually, with what I know now, if I had known as much now as I knew then, I'm not sure I would have taken the job, but he convinced me. And Ken also did a very good job of talking me through what the options would be there and so forth. It was a vice president level job. I was a director, a senior director or something at Zeneca. And I'd been the youngest person ever at Zeneca, as far as I knew, to ever become a director. But this really, money had a piece of it, but it was really about impact. I could have an impact on this firm, unlike anything I could see over the next 10 years, any job they would give me at Zeneca over the next 10 years. I was 37 at the time. I had young children. The family aspects of this were not insignificant. Both sets of folks were getting older, and family was very important to both my wife and me. We had been bending over backwards for many years as we were corporate vagabonds trying to make sure that the kids knew their cousins and their grandparents and aunts and uncles, and this move would have made that much easier. So it seemed like a pretty clear decision when time came down. I was unnerved, frankly, more by this disconnect on the offer than I I pretty much satisfied, I guess another way to say it is, I pretty much satisfied all of my diligence questions and gotten comfortable that I was going to have the scope to do the job that I thought needed to be done. And so the likelihood of professional success felt good to me. And then the other stuff was sort of more life issues than it was professional issues. The fact that there was, it was nowhere near as robust at the time as it has become since, but, you know, Genzyme was in the area, Millennium was had been up and running, there were a few other small companies up and running, suggested to me that if this didn't work out, if I did my part of it the way I thought I could do it, I would be fine, my family would be fine. So it never felt like a hugely risky decision. But I did like the fact that a big chunk of my compensation was only going to be realized is if I had a positive impact on the firm. And that's all I want. I want, that's what drove me, is that positive, can I have an impact, not just on the firm, but given the kinds of drugs, it's also, in order to have an impact on the firm, I had to have an impact on patients too. That was a big part of the difference too, as I did my diligence. Everybody at Biogen was very focused on the patients, and at Zeneca, it didn't always come up. It was about the opportunity for the drug, what kind of revenues we could generate, what kind of margin we could generate. It's not that we ignored the patients, but it wasn't central. At Biogen, it was central. And they had done terrific work understanding the life of a person with MS, evaluating beta-sarin, which had been in the market a couple of years before. Go ahead.
Yeah, just a minute.
Need some power.
Yeah. There we go.
That also felt right to me. So, anyway. So I immediately, upon joining Biogen, I got these CVs. I started pawing through them. I wanted to build a team that was complementary. We'd done some work on competency-based evaluation and so forth at Zeneca, and I'd taken what the corporation was doing, and I'd taken it maybe two steps further in the sales organization as I thought about this new model and what leadership in the new model would look like. And so as I went through I figured the first thing I needed to do was get a few more hands on deck, because I'd never built a fleet. There's all kinds of stuff here that I didn't know how to do, but I knew what we needed to do. So I hired... I spent the first roughly 5 weeks splitting my time between interviewing sales managers and trying to educate the internal organization about what it meant to have a commercial operation, all the way up to Vincent. Jim, you know, he'd built five companies, self-described, in high tech, Abbott Diagnostics being one of them, and he really felt like there was very little I could teach him.
So the previous products that Biogen had developed, their partners are doing?
They hadn't developed. They'd licensed the technology, and the partners had developed, and we got a royalty on it. Brilliant move. Jim saved the company by his ability to do that. Yeah. They were in the market and generating, as I said, about $300 million of 100% margin. You know, we'd have half of one analyst looking at the data, trying to predict what our royalty rate was going to be so we could plan our business. But other than that, we had no cost associated with this revenue. And he managed the company so that he, you know, some quarters he'd make a penny and some quarters he'd lose a penny. He basically was managing to break even so he didn't have to keep going back to the market. So I remember I made three offers that were accepted for regional managers. And they all started on the same day. So one of them was one of the guys who had worked for me at Zeneca, which was interesting. I sort of had committed to myself that I was not going to recreate Zeneca, that both I owed it to Zeneca to not disrupt their business, but also I wanted to create something that was different. So I never, ever, at Biogen, proactively reached out to a Zeneca colleague to see if they would come and join us. What had happened was there was a young man who had worked for me a little bit on one of the project teams in the SAP project. He actually come in when I gotten promoted out of the Diprovan product management job. My assistant product manager got promoted into the role. I was told, make sure that he's ready to handle this launch. They wouldn't tell me why, but so and so to fill his assistant product manager role, we brought in a district manager from Southern California, who I played in a basketball league with, a corporate basketball league, and so I got to know him that way, and was very impressed with him. And then we were putting together a team to define what kind of reports that we need to have out of this system in order to manage the business. So I got the senior marketing guy, the senior sales guy, and I said to them, we need some young people as well. And so we all agreed that Rob would be one of them. So I left, and Rob, about 2 weeks after I left, when I was still in the sorting phase, which of these people do I want to interview, and I was flying around the country interviewing these potential sales managers, he asked me if I'd be willing to give him some advice. So I said, sure. And he called me and he said, I've been approached by Amgen. He was a regional manager for Zeneca in Southern California. So he'd come in, done the dipper van job, gotten promoted as we redid the sales stuff to Southern California. He was actually, I think, in San Francisco at the time. But his family and his home were in Southern California. Been approached by Amgen to basically take the same job at Amgen. And he wanted to bounce it off of me. So I listened to his rationale. I asked him a bunch of questions, et cetera, et cetera. But I said to him, look, if you've made the one of the questions I asked him is, have you decided you're going to leave Zeneca? And he said, I think I have, because I really would like to be in a firm where I can build a career without having to move transcontinentally all the time. I said, well, I'm not sure I can meet that, but if you've made the decision you're going to leave Zeneca, I think you should co-process an opportunity, the same job with us that you're processing with Amgen. Obviously, if you take the Amgen job and you do well, you're going to be able to stay in Southern California and build your career. If you do that here, you're going to have to move cross country again, but I think you should have some alternatives. So he said yes. Rob, this man ended up being my successor at Cubist. So he and two other guys, each from different divisions of J&J, started on the same day, and it was early in November of 95. And I can remember that, they did all the paperwork, so that at 10:30 they came into my office and I had a big whiteboard like this. And I had put on the whiteboard all the tasks we had to get done between now and April 1st.
Got 5 months or something, less than 5 months.
It's early November and we've got to be April 1st, right, so it's 5 months. And I said, okay, who knows anything about, and literally this is how we did it. First we said, okay, what have I forgotten? We added a couple of things, and then we said, okay, who knows anything about this? Okay, you got assignment for that. Who knows anything about this? Okay, you're going to take that one. I'm going to take this one, et cetera. Those three, they were all men. I ended up hiring a very diverse leadership team, but the first three were all men. To this day, it's 20 years. To this day, reflect on that meeting. The whiteboard meeting. They'd all come from much larger organizations. They'd never, all this stuff had been done for them. But they remember it as incredibly energizing. And one of the three had been much more senior at one of the divisions of J&J. In fact, he was a vice president in one of their divisions.
How did you get it?
He was very enamored of the mission. I think he saw the growth potential. And quite frankly, the values of Biogen and how I interpreted those values, I think, meant an awful lot to him. He'd been in some situations at the division that he was in J&J that were uncomfortable to him, and yet I think he had the perception, I'm not sure it was accurate or not, he had the perception that that this is what you were going to need to do to continue to build your career in that business. And I think he came away from, because remember, he'd met a bunch of people previously because he'd been a candidate for the job I had. So he'd met a bunch of the Biogen folks. And he saw that I sort of shared their view around values. And I think he just got comfortable with that, and he liked the Greenfield aspect of it as well. But he was much more experienced than I was, and than these other two guys were. But he was a great member of the team. So, you know, away we went, and it was we had to put in customer relationship software. We had to size the sales force, which I'd done a lot of that work since I could do that in my sleep. I'd done that before I hired these guys, so that was part of what we were talking about in the interview process. And away we went. We were launch ready on April 7th, meaning we had everybody hired, we had the customer service model staffed, the partnerships done, we had our distribution plan in place, we had everybody trained, and then we waited. And the approval came on a Friday in May. We knew we were going to get a patent challenge. So that meant that having patients on the drug and benefiting from it was critical. Mm-hmm. So we had set up a process. We got a fax from the FDA at 11 a.m. on a Friday morning saying Avonex is approved, here's what your label looks like. And we had people stationed at every place they needed to be along the supply chain to edit and correct and ensure the label was right. And we had patients by noon on Saturday, we had patients injecting. We had various MS centers around the country who were on notice. And so by noon, 24 hours after we got the notice, we had people injecting Avonex.
So the physicians were waiting for this.
Yeah. Yep. So we it was a two-product market at that time, but we had a much better label and I think a better product. It was more convenient, fewer side effects. We had better data in terms of affecting the course of the disease, et cetera. And we went to school on the mistakes that the Schering folks had made when they launched Betaseron. We'd set up a model. We didn't know how successful, but we had a very patient-intensive model. So in those days, retail wouldn't do assignment of benefits, and these were expensive therapies. And so we were very concerned about patients' ability to pay out of pocket and then wait, submit the claim to the insurance company, and then wait for reimbursement. Mm-hmm. So we set up a single 800 number, and on that, you would call that 800 number, and first you would get a live human being, never a recording. And that human being would listen to your question, and you could report an adverse event, you could ask about insurance, you could ask about distribution, you could ask about training. It was a self-injected sub-Q. IM. And I had encouraged, but not insisted. I had done it myself. We had the manufacturing guys fill those IM syringes with saline, and as part of the training, we all injected ourselves. No, we didn't all do it. But everyone had the opportunity to do it. So we understood the patient experience. So we had nurses that would come in and train a patient or train a patient's caregiver, husband, wife, whatever, to do this injection.
And you're talking about things that Schering hadn't done before? So this
nope.
Is, yeah.
And we would send it to your pharmacy, but we had somebody on the distribution end who would take assignment of benefits. So you could go to your pharmacy and pick it up. They got a small stipend for that. They never had to pay for it. Got paid for differently, and we take assignment of benefits. Retail now doesn't. I think in part because of what we did. We would ship it directly to your house. If that's what we had set up a national distribution through a pharmacy, a mail order pharmacy, they would take assignment of benefits. We coordinated the nurse training was part of the deal. What happened was, and we didn't know the volume, right? We didn't know the volume of calls we were going to get to the call center. So we create this very interesting model where it was a temp to perm model, right? So we brought in a bunch of people. We said the first handful, four or five of them, something like that, we said, we're going to train you. And when this drug gets approved, you'll become a full-time employee. And then that all worked. And then we lined up a whole bunch of additional people that said, okay, if the volume increases, we're going to do the same thing for you. And that worked great. We ended up, by the time I left in 2000, we had more customer service representatives answering these phones and dealing with all these issues than we had salespeople.
Yeah. This is a pretty complex system.
Very complex and
novel.
Unprecedented.
So did it come together as sort of... a combination of things that the different people you brought in to for the team came up with, pulling pieces from?
How did it come together? Yeah. We had, as I said, the Mark and Mark, Luchtenberger and Staybach and Lilla, had done a lot of work to understand what the life of an MS person was like and what had worked for Betaseron and what had not worked for Betaseron. They had a strong relationship with the National MS Society as well, so we had access to patients. We could talk to them about what was going on. So in that first couple of months as I was recruiting, any time I went out to on a recruiting trip, I'd go to the local MS chapter and I'd sit down with patients and talk, hear them out. And they had, Mark and Mark and Lilla, had a concept about how to do it differently. What they didn't have was the experience to figure out how to operationalize it. That's what I brought. How do you deal with the wholesalers in this circumstance? You know, you can't really, I think it required a cold chain, if I remember correctly. So how are we going to handle distribution and that kind of stuff? So we figured that all out, and we actually developed a relationship with this mail-order pharmacy in Tennessee, Accretive Health. I forget what they're called. Accredo, they're called now. That business was built on the back of Avonex. So I can remember, I have it somewhere in one of my offices. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal soon after we launched that was titled "The Avonex Launch: A Thing of Beauty." And even today, it's 20 years
later. Where was this?
Wall Street Journal.
Wall Street Journal. Okay.
Even today, occasionally, although they haven't done it in the last few years, they'll reference that Avonex launch in terms of the most successful biotech launch ever. We weren't in the market 6 months before we had market share. We were getting more than 50% of the new prescriptions, at which point we changed our marketing focus from differentiation, how is Avonex different than Betaseron, to who's appropriate for it, to market growth. So we started working more with MS Society, more with neurologists around. Up till that point, neurologists didn't want to diagnose MS, because they couldn't offer the patients anything. And frankly, the way neurologists operated in those days, they were often solo practitioners. They might have a receptionist and them. They didn't have the staff. And we knew this was going to be an issue, which is part of the reason we built all this. And all they needed to do was call an 800 number, write the prescription, call an 800 number, and we'd tell them where to fax it. And we could take care of the patient from that point, and we would loop it back to the doc. So the doc was always in the loop. He could keep, or she could keep, her records up to date, what was happening with the patient. We could handle, in a compliant way, adverse events, adverse event reporting. Within 2 years of the launch, we were getting more adverse event reports because we essentially had this enormous MS support network through our CSRs. We were getting more adverse event reports than Glaxo was getting. Because the patients would call us, and when you started this drug, you got terrible flu-like symptoms. It was just part of beta interferon. And every time, of course, a company employee or an agent hears something like that, you have to report it. And so we could do that in a warm transfer. We had specialists who were pharmacovigilance specialists. So you get the CSR, the patient or the caregiver would be talking to the CSR. They'd record everything, not record like this, but they'd listen to everything. We did what was called a warm transfer at the time. So they'd call, if it was a safety report, they'd call a pharmacovigilance specialist, and they'd say, I have Mary Smith on the line. Mary Smith started Avonex 3 weeks ago. She's experiencing these symptoms. And then they would connect Mary Smith to the pharmacovigilance expert, and Mary Smith wouldn't have to repeat, ever. It didn't matter if pharmacovigilance or distribution or reimbursement or whatever. Mm-hmm. We handled it. It was an incredibly positive experience for the patients to engage with this.
Mm-hmm. They get their message across.
And even today when I call somebody, you know, well, first you have to go through the, you know, press one if it's this, press two if it's that, not. We tracked each individual CSR and each individual call. If the calls weren't answered in less than 5 seconds, we'd add a person. And we'd listen in on calls, we'd coach them, we did a lot of training on these people. We hired bachelor degree people. These were young professionals. And it was very rewarding for them. It was a hard job, though, because they were often hearing terrible stories about, not about the drug sometimes about the drug, but often just the lives of these patients. I woke up this morning in a flare. I can't get out of bed. Can you send someone to help me? That kind of thing. So we ended up, as we got more mass, we'd rotate them. They end up getting about a week, a month off the phones, doing support and quality work, training work, so that we give them a little bit of an emotional break. But many of them didn't even want to take that because they developed phone relationships with these patients. You know, they'd call and they'd say, we eventually got a system that was so sophisticated based on the phone number of the incoming person, you'd get to a small team. So the teams were regionally oriented. And a patient would call and say, you know, oh, you're Robbie, you're great, but actually I was talking to Mary about this. Can you transfer to me, Mary? And we could do all that. So it was very novel, I think, and it was and the sales force really felt like they were making a difference in the patients' lives too. We had to go through it when HIPAA was passed, we had to go through all the, you know, we got permissions, et cetera, et cetera. So we were very conscious of compliance, but we were very focused on supporting the patients through this terrible experience of having this diagnosis and then having to self-inject. And you felt awful for the first few months, but we tracked when they would drop off therapy, and we then interview the patients, and we try and figure out what can we do to keep them on therapy, because you're never going to get the benefit if you don't take it.
You're working with physicians on that as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, but the physicians, most of the MS centers had the staff to be able to be supportive of the patients, but a high percentage of the patients were not treated at MS centers. They were treated at individual neurologist offices. And in those days, it was a receptionist and a neurologist, and there was nobody to provide the support, so we sort of did it for them. But we always kept them in the loop, so they never felt like they were blindsided because we've done something with the patient that they should have been aware of. So, did that, launched the drug, 6 months in, we changed the focus from differentiation to market growth. You as a person with MS have the right to be treated to have a better future. And that was a very difficult internal transition to make. Our sales organization, I remember one joint regional meeting as we were rolling this out, a number of the reps said, you're asking us to teach neurologists how to practice medicine. That's not what we do. And I had to get up and say to them, look, we're not telling them how to practice medicine. What we're telling them is these patients have an option to have a better future. You owe it to them to make the diagnosis and let them make the decision. Get them involved. MS, people with MS are very knowledgeable about their disease. They're generally, it's mostly women. They're generally very well educated. It's a disease that has a genetic component. If you're of Northern European descent, you grew up within X and Y in the latitudes, degrees of latitude, you had increased risk. So we almost had a revolution when we made this change, because we were only, you know, six months into the launch and we're rolling out this new thing. But we let a few people go who just couldn't make the transition, and I took one regional manager out of the job because he was not supportive of this. But it was clearly the right thing to do for the patients. So we did it. So then Ken resigned. So Ken was my boss. He's a large part of the reason I came. I figured he's a CFO. He'd been CFO at Biogen for many years, been CFO at a big industrial company before that. It was a real gap, I felt, in my development. I understood a P&L, but I didn't understand how you raise money. I didn't understand how you interact with the street, any of that stuff. And he committed that he would teach me how to do that. I came to work for him. And then, for reasons I don't think we need to go into, he decided to abruptly resign. And we were right in the Vincent Tobin transition period. Mm-hmm. And they made Mark Luchtenberger the head of sales and marketing. And I nearly resigned. Mark's a terrific guy. We wouldn't have had Avonex without him. But it's very clear to me, I'd launched tons of drugs. He didn't know how to do this, but he was very well thought of by Jim Vincent in particular, I think, and Jim Vincent owed him a debt of gratitude, because despite Vincent's efforts to kill Avonex in development, Mark and Irv Smith had advocated to keep it alive. So he became, one of my key theses for coming to work here was learning this financial stuff. Now the guy who could teach me that's gone. And I hadn't had a chance to learn it because I've been so focused on building the organization, launching the drug. So what they did at the same time that they promoted Mark is they made me, in addition to VP of sales, they made me the Avonex program exec. So the model at Biogen at that time was the program leader was sort of supposed to be the CEO of the program and figure out what the strategy for the ongoing development of the asset was, etc. And the way it was, so Tobin asked me to come to his office. He said, we'd like you to do this. In this role, you're going to report directly to me, so you're going to have a dual reporting relationship to Mark and to me. And that helped a lot, because Jim had also grown up in the finance world. He obviously had a lot of experience in the with the street. So it gave me the opportunity to fill the gap that I felt had been created by Ken's departure. But he said, you're going to have two jobs in this program management, the traditional program management function. How do we continue to develop this drug? Are there other indications, et cetera? But you're also going to be going to Europe. Jim Mullen had just been appointed the head of our European subsidiary. Jim had come out of manufacturing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, his whole career had been in manufacturing. He said, you're going to be side by side with Jim to build the European infrastructure so that we have as successful a launch there as we've had in the U.S. I said, well, what's your expectations? He said, you're going to be in Europe at least a week, maybe 2 weeks a month for the foreseeable future. And so this was great. I built a really strong team. We promoted one of the regional people to a national sales manager role. So he took some of my direct reports, and then I did, in fact, for about 18 months, spend at least a week a month in Europe with Jim, sitting in his senior team meetings, helping him recruit that whole leadership team, and then the people below them, the country regional guys, and all of that stuff. And we launched there, and then Jim came back as COO in 98. Jim Mullen did. Mark Luchtenberger went over to take his role, and I became the chief commercial guy at that point. And a few months later, we gave the program leadership job to the country manager from France who worked for Jim Mullen. Jim Tobin made all of that happen early in December of 97, and then December of 98, and then just before Christmas of 98, it was announced he was leaving, and that's, I'm sure you've heard, there was sort of a him or me kind of conversation with the board, and the board said him, and so Jim Tobin left. Jim Vincent came back as CEO. Mullen became the COO, but it was very clear that Mullen was going to become the CEO unless he screwed up. I was a big advocate for that. Jim and I had developed an effective relationship. Our styles are very different, but I think we shared a lot I never had a disagreement with Jim on any element of strategy. So he came back, he became my boss when I was chief commercial officer, and at this point we're now working on building out the portfolio and getting prepared for the next launch and that kind of stuff. And we got to the budgeting cycle in 99, and I put in the budget, and I always felt like you can't do this definitively, but there should be some relationship between how much you think you need to spend commercially and what kind of revenue you can generate, right? So I said, look, here's what I think we can generate next year. Here's how much it's going to take. And I think it was 8% of the revenue. Jim had the view that we had become fat and happy in the U.S. and that we were spending money like big pharma. And so he said, no, I want the revenue's right, but you have to cut this. I said, fine, you're the boss. I'll do whatever you want me to do. But understand that I don't believe I can deliver that revenue. I will support it. I will advocate for it publicly, but I don't think you're going to get it. In fact, with that budget, you're going to get this revenue number. It's my right. Assessment. He said, I'm willing to take that risk. I said, fine. And the other thing that was going on, sort of the dynamic between Jim and me at that time, was he didn't seem like he would. It seemed like he asked, what's the best way to say this? Jim was very comfortable making decisions without a lot of input. But it seemed like the key decisions, strategy decisions, business development decisions, personnel decisions, he wouldn't make without consulting me, which was very flattering, and I felt like I was really having an impact. So I was quite confused in this as we went through this. The area that the business I know the best, you seem to have less confidence in me than the areas of the business I know the least or that I don't know as much anyway. And we had a lot of conversations about this, and we worked it all out. So we signed up for this revenue, we signed up for this cost base in for 2000, and 2000 unfolded, and we hit the revenue I told him we were going to hit, which was not the revenue that was in the plan. And we got into the budget cycle, and he said, and the same, it was repeating itself. At which point I said, look, Jim, I'm spending way too much of my time and emotional energy away from my family for this to continue. So I think it's time for me to resign. And he asked me to hold off. That was in the summer of 2000. He asked me to hold off, and he spent a couple of months trying to define a new role for me. He said, you've been in this job too long. You're tired. I get it. So I said, I'm not really that tired. I think the cost of my family has been substantial. I felt as though the return I was getting for it professionally was a balance. I don't feel like I'm getting that professional return. You don't seem to have confidence that I know what I'm doing in this part of the business. So better for you to find someone you have confidence in. He offered me designed a bunch of different jobs, offered them to me. None of them made any sense to me. So I was getting ready to leave in September, and he asked me to stay on till the end of the year and lead a research discovery project. He recruited, Joe Davies had retired. He recruited in Mike Gilman. Mike Gilman had gotten off to a great start in 2000, but he was still getting his arms. Mike was still getting his arms around, what do we have in discovery, both assets and capabilities. So he was saying to Jim, I understand you want to do a new discovery strategy for Biogen, but I don't have the bandwidth to deliver that to you right now. But Jim, I think, had committed to doing it, had delivering to the board in December. So he asked me to work with BCG and to work through a discovery strategy that Mike would support, but that Mike couldn't have time to spend in depth with BCG. Another wonderful opportunity for me personally. I mean, he's a commercial guy who's being asked to learn about all of our discovery. I'd been involved some, I had some, but, and come up with a discovery strategy that the guy who's going to have to implement it would buy into, even though he couldn't have a lot of time developing it. It was a very interesting period. He took me out of the commercial role, which was fine, named Bob Hamm to be my successor. So I was there to help Bob as he transitioned in. And I worked with BCG on this discovery project. We presented it to the board in the December board meeting. I didn't present it because I was leaving at that point. We had agreed that at the end of the year I was going to retire. So BCG and Michael presented it to the board. They did invite me to the board dinner that evening, the holiday celebration, and highlight of my career was in the cocktail hour beforehand, Phil Sharp walked in and told me that this was the most well thought through research strategy he'd ever seen. So here's a Nobel laureate, founder of the company.
And was he on the board at that time?
He was on the board, yeah. Mm-hmm. He and Jim Vincent were very close. And the other, I can't remember her name, but the woman who was the chief technology officer for the Clinton White House, from the University of Arkansas, was also on the board at that point. And independent of Phil, she approached me and said something similar. So that was a wicked highlight for me.
Can you talk about some of the details of the strategy?
Well, we came at it from a whole host of positions. Should we have, most biopharma companies develop strategy based on therapeutic areas. And so we examined that. Should we broaden beyond, sort of neuroimmunology, et cetera? We looked at it from the standpoint of we were right, this was at the point just before the final mapping of the human genome. maybe we should think about this from the standpoint of biologic pathways and let the biology drive, you know, whatever our commercial or development activity should be and so forth. And that's essentially where we ended up. And we thought, it looks very prescient now, we thought that our strengths in immunology could be expanded beyond neuroimmunology to other immunologic diseases, including cancer. So we said we should really double down on immunology, but we should put some cancer biologists into our discovery organization and move in that direction. And in fact, what happened was soon after I left, I forget the dates, but you can look them up, Jim went out and negotiated a deal to buy IDEC, and that's how he got his cancer biology expertise. I'm not sure that I would... I am sure it was not part of the strategy that we do a merger of equals with an oncology company. What we delivered was an organic plan to organically grow this, but we thought immunology could have, even back in 2000, we thought immunology could have a significant role to play in oncology, and that it would leverage expertise that we already had.
So that was not, while you were still there, there were no discussions about acquisitions at that time?
Not of IDEC. We had done, you know, this is one of the confusing things. We had a VLA-4 program, small molecule program, that we had partnered with Merck and had been working on for some time. And we just couldn't get evidence of clinical effect. So Elan had this antibody VLA program, which became Tysabri. And Jim Vincent didn't want to do a big deal in MS because he felt like it would just cannibalize Avonex and it wouldn't be incremental. So one of the things I had been asked to do, and I can't remember if it was Tobin or Mullen, I think it was Mullen who asked me to do this, was to present to Jim and to the board a therapeutic area, not a therapeutic area, a franchise view of the MS market and as underpinnings for why we should do this, what turned out to be the Tysabri deal, the VLA-4 deal. So I had done that and I had put together a whole bunch of different scenarios given assumptions around what the profile of this product could be eventually, and it was very specific around VLA-4, but it wasn't limited to VLA-4. And I'm not sure I ever truly convinced Jim Vincent, but I convinced him enough that he let Mullen do the deal. And this was, again, one of those examples where I was a little confused. So I'd had experience doing BD, but I had never done a deal of this size, and I'd never been in the room with the CEO doing the deal. And as we worked this through, he asked me to join him with the chairman of CEO and chairman of Elan, and their BD kid, Seamus Mulligan. Is that a perfect name or what? Wonderful guy. and to come with him to New York and see if we couldn't get this thing closed. So we did. I can remember we had dinner in a hotel suite so that nobody could see us, and we did what turned out to be the Tysabri deal, which I think probably cost Jim Mullen, subsequent to that, many years of his life, given both the relationship with Elan, but also the PML issue and how that is a wonderful story, the way they worked through, they pulled it and worked through it, and that's a really terrific story, I think, for the patients. And it looks to me like Tysabri, for some small subset of patients, actually allows them to regrow myelin, and it doesn't just halt the disease. In some patients, it looks like it may at least a little bit reverse the ravages.
Yeah. So who would be the people to talk to get that story? Jim Mullen, and who else would be key?
Jim Mullen was the key guy to do the deal. I'm trying to remember who our BD head was at the time. It was Case Bain. He was new in that role, and if I remember correctly, our conversations with Elan predated Case, but he was central to it. Do you know Case?
No.
I've lost track of where Case is. He was CEO. He left Biogen a few years after me and became CEO of this captive, Fidelity captive CNS company that Deborah Dunsire is now the CEO of. It was named something different when Case led it, but He would be one. We also put one of the guys I had taken a risk on in the commercial organization. He'd been hired as one of our salespeople, brought into marketing very quickly after we launched, had a variety of roles inside commercial, and then we made him the Canadian country manager way before most people would have done that. He did a fantastic job. His name was Andrew Comiotti. He became the program exec for Tesabri after we brought it in, before it was named Tesabri, mm-hmm. as a development opportunity for him and to lead the development program, the coordination between the two companies. Mm-hmm. He could give you some of that too.
Yeah, okay.
He's at Genzyme mm-hmm. now running their MS business.
You mentioned taking a risk on people. Is that something that, did you do that a lot? Was that part of your operating formula? Or?
It was what I would consider a liberating aspect of the Biogen experience relative to the Zeneca experience. Biogen was very willing to take risks on people. Think about it. I mean, the guy they put as chief commercial for their first proprietary product launch was the ex-CFO, incredibly talented guy. They took a manufacturing guy and made him head of Europe to prepare for a launch. They asked me to do a research strategy. You know, it was something that Biogen was willing to do to a much greater degree than I had seen previously, and it just seemed to make a lot of sense to me. I'd seen so many highly talented people at Zeneca who weren't moved along very quickly. And when they were moved along, it was in a very sort of vertical way. They weren't given breadth, they were given depth. Mm-hmm. That it made all kinds of sense to me. And I was an early and strong advocate for it. And Andrew, and there were a couple of other people too that came into the commercial. Oh, there's a woman now. That's awesome. We actually hired her. I didn't hire her, but our chief compliance officer at Cubist hired her. Was brought in as a sales rep. We call them area business managers. Long, very successful salesperson in biopharma. She's now an industry expert on compliance. Not patient compliance, regulatory right. compliance. And she goes everywhere. Doing that compliance work. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of this at Cubist. Yeah. We did this a lot. I mean, we had a small organization, but where we could, we did it quite frequently. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, but I think I'd much rather lose a person because you've overstretched them than lose a person because you've under-challenged them.
Yeah. I'm just wondering, do you think that's a function of size at a certain point that an organization gets to be... So just to have the operating stability that you have to follow.
I think what happens is as organizations get bigger, functional leaders become mini czars, and an extraordinary percentage of organizational energy is spent protecting and enhancing the silo. And if that's your orientation, you don't let your best people go. And I think that's the fundamental problem. I don't think there's anything inherent in a large organization necessarily being unwilling to take risks on people. I just think that internal politics makes it very difficult for that to be a key part of the culture.
Yeah.
I will not disclose to you with whom I've had this conversation, but one of the major pharma CEOs and I have engaged in a conversation about this particular shortcoming as it relates to developing his successor. And, you know, people come up in a pipe. If you start in clinical development, you end your career at that company in clinical development. If you start in commercial, you end in commercial. If you start in manufacturing, you end in manufacturing. Except at the highest level. The highest level, they'll move people around if they look like succession candidates. But I have experienced some of those people from this very company, and they are not broad thinkers.
Yeah.
When you're 55 years old and you've spent 30 years in one function, you can't spend 2 years in another function and really understand the nuance of it.
Yeah.
You can't put yourself in that perspective. You do that job from the perspective that you developed in 30 years.
Yeah. You had an opportunity at Zeneca to do...
And that was not necessarily part of the culture there?
It was not at all part of the culture. I think the reason I had that opportunity is I had a very strong reputation for delivering results. And the guy whose butt was on the line was a commercial guy. So when he was told by the consultants, you need somebody who can lead broadly, his initial thought was, okay, who's my best commercial leader? Not who's my best leader in the organization, who's my best commercial leader? Because that's where he grew up. And I just lucked out to be somebody that people thought was that person.
Yeah, and it was also a function of the, you know, they have to split up the organizations, right?
So, right. Yeah. It was mission critical. It was very clear to me that his butt was on the line. If we weren't successful in this project, he was not going anywhere except out the door. So,
have we concluded the Biogen story?
Pretty much, yeah.
We're at 2:40. You've got a 3:00 call. We've got the Cubist story ahead. Should we do this another time?
I've got my calls at 3:30.
Oh, 3:30.
So I have let's go until 3:15.
Okay.
And then if you feel like you'd like to spend more time on Cubist, we'll spend more time on Cubist.
Okay.
Let's see where
we get. Yeah.
So I retired from Biogen in January of 2001. And there were two things in terms of what I was looking to do. One was to develop, my kids were 13, 11, and 7, and my two oldest were girls. And I knew that if I was going to have the kind of relationship that I had always envisioned having with my children, I needed to get on it. 15-year-old girls don't want to spend a lot of time with their dad, right? And the second thing was I had been so focused on building my career and providing for my family that I had not really ever been able to give back to the community. And the way I was raised was, if you're fortunate enough to be fortunate, you better pay it forward. So I thought I would step away and spend some time with my children and have the second part of my professional life be in the nonprofit world. So we pulled the kids from school, we traveled extensively, I threw myself into a handful of nonprofits. Oldest child was in eighth grade, so we really didn't want to move her given the experience I'd had moving multiple times in high school. So we were very committed to this area. And after about, I would say, 6 or 7 months, it became quite apparent to me that at least the nonprofits I had gotten involved with were not going to provide the intellectual stimulation, the pace, or the impact that I wanted to have in my professional life. And my wife at this point had stopped working. She was a full-time, she didn't stop working, she stopped working outside the house. She's a full-time mom. She was very active in the community. She was on the local school foundation. She was giving back a lot. And I didn't want my kids to grow up in a home where neither parent worked. So that summer of 2001, I decided I would start re-engaging. And I thought, I'm a builder. What really has turned me on over the last 5 or 8 years of my career has been building something new. So I started with very early stage technology companies in healthcare. We lived in Sudbury at the time. I went Boston to Worcester, anything in that area. And I spent days with numerous companies, 10, 12, 8, 15 person companies. I could see how I could contribute. I could see where the technology could go. For both commercial and societal benefit, but I didn't feel that passion. So I spent some time after I had done this for a few weeks, met with half a dozen companies that come home and said, it was more analytical than passion. I think you have to do stuff that you can get passionate about. It's hard to build these companies. And if you're not passionate, if this is just a job, you shouldn't try to build a life sciences company.
So you didn't come across the right
thing. And after reflecting, what I found was they were too far from patients. That it was the distance, the amount of time and energy it was going to take to get the technology from where it was into a patient in clinical development that created that passion gap, as I called it. So I redirected my search to companies that were in the clinic. I can remember this happened just about the same time as 9/11. I was in my car headed out to mountain bike in Harvard. And my wife called me and she said, "Oh my God, what's going on?" And I turned around and came home and I watched that. And I don't want to over-dramatize it because it didn't feel like it at the time, but that was, I think in retrospect, one of the things that said, "Oh, don't waste your 40, whatever I was, 2001, I was 43 years old. Do not waste this productive period of your life doing something that you don't feel is real important." So I was talking to a number of the development stage companies in the area. I had a good enough reputation that pretty much anybody would talk to me. Not everybody had a need, but pretty much anyone would talk to me. Soon after that, there was a notice in the journal that Cubist had parted ways with its COO. I didn't envision being a CEO. And a guy I had trained 20 years before, Tom Chen, at my very first training class, which was one of the best when I was a sales training instructor at ICI, was the head of marketing at Cubist at the time, and a neighbor. And so I called Tom and I said, "I saw this notice, you know, what do you think? Would I be a good fit? Do I have the right skills, etc.?" He said, "Well, I don't think we're going to replace him." So I just moved on and I was talking to other people. And then he called me back a few weeks later and said, "We just had a board meeting, we are going to replace him. I think you should throw your hat in the ring." So I did. And I ended up whittling it down over the fall of 2001 to two opportunities. One, the Cubist opportunity, and one other. Cubist opportunity was a COO role, the other one was not. It was a less traditional organization. I knew of Frank. When we launched that second generation cephalosporin way back when at Zeneca, Frank had been at Tufts, and he was a leading light academic ID guy. And he blew us apart. There was a side chain on the chemical structure of cefetetan that he was very concerned about. Turns out he was right. But I knew his name from that. I'd never met him. But he was a force of nature, and I spent a lot of time with him in my diligence and got convinced that Cubicin needed to see the light of day. Had lost track of the fact that everybody had gotten out of antibiotics, so he sort of helped, he and Scott helped me understand the opportunity set, not just for the drug, but also for the strategy and for humanity.
So what was the picture back at that time?
So in 2001, most of the big companies had left. A few more left after that. There were still a few in the space, but most had left. We hadn't had a new antibiotic of any substance since Biaxin and the Zithromax, which had been launched in the 93-94 time frame. Levaquin had come in. Everyone was headed toward quinolones, and you know, I had this quinolone experience with temofloxacin that had been launched and pulled, and Frank actually taught me a lot more about quinolones and why you really should only use them as a last resort. They upregulate a gene in bacteria that cause more genetic mutations as a way to evade them. And so you actually, the more quinolone you put into the environment, this may be a little bit of an overstatement, but it's generally true. The more quinolone you put in the environment, the greater the likelihood that you're going to get resistance, and you're going to get resistance clones in many different ways, because you're increasing the bacteria's ability to mutate when you turn on this gene. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it was very clear to me in both circumstances what needed to be done, but in the other circumstance, I was having a harder time being convinced that the leadership of that firm had the heart to do what they needed to do. They were saying the right words, but I'm not sure that I wasn't convinced that they could act in concert with that intellectual view. Cubist was very clear to me how my skills could be applied. The conversation, the diligence that the board did on me, it was around a COO. There was some talk about potential succession, but it wasn't. I didn't join Cubist expecting to become the CEO. I joined Cubist expecting to get them ready to launch Cubism.
Yeah, and you, the thought of being a CEO, that was not an ambition or hadn't crossed your mind anywhere or something?
No, I, I wouldn't go that far, but I didn't think I was ready. I was 43 mm-hmm. or whatever. 2001, it's 43. I thought I needed more development. I was probably a little intimidated both because my dad had been a CEO basically the whole time I knew him and was this sort of larger-than-life guy. Think of my experience. The CEOs I'd gotten to know were him, Jim Vincent, mm-hmm. Jim Tobin, but who was a much more accessible guy than Jim Vincent, but and the Zeneca CEO, he had a scar. He's a rugby player, terrific guy, but again, a larger-than-life guy. And I'm not a larger-than-life guy. I'm a behind-the-scenes. I can get in front of a crowd and get them all fired up, but I've learned how to do that. That's not something I wake up every morning desiring to do. I don't think I'm the smartest guy in the room, unlike most of these people. So I thought I needed more experience. In fact, I can remember I called both Jim Tobin and Ken Bate, two important mentors in my professional life, as I was going through the search, and I asked them if I could buy them lunch. And basically what I was saying to them is, do you think I can be a COO? They both commented on that over the years. They both said yes, that I thought I could be a successful COO. So I took that job at Cubis. I tried to get the other company not to make me an offer. I was very explicit with them, but they made me an offer anyway, which I then had to turn down. But I took the Cubis job. I started on January 2nd, and we had two phase 3 studies for daptomycin successfully in the bank. And we had one pneumonia study that had just finished, and a second pneumonia study that was, this is community-acquired pneumonia, that was enrolling. It was about 50% enrolled.
And there were two studies that were for different indication, is it?
Yeah, so up until that time, to get an antibiotic approved, you had to have multiple indications. The FDA knew that docs do a relatively straightforward calculation. Does the antibiotic kill the bacteria I'm worried about? Yes or no? If it's yes, then the second question they ask is, does it get to the site that the bacteria is causing the infection? If the answer to that is yes, then they'll say, I don't really care what the indication site is. I got a pretty good chance of solving the problem here. So as a result, your safety database had to be bigger, and you had to look at multiple indications. So they had in only one circumstance where there was a resistant bacteria, Vieria, it was a few years before 2001, 99 I think, had they approved a drug based on less than two indications, and they approved under a special protocol because there was nothing that was working against vanc-resistant enterococci. So we had two successful phase 3 studies in skin, complicated skin. These are post-surgical nasty skin infections. And we were doing pneumonia. And I signed all the papers on whatever that first day was, you know. And Scott, my predecessor, asked me to have lunch with him. So I went into his office and we had lunch. And he said, look, we've unblinded the data of the first pneumonia study and the drug has failed. I said, oh, is that something? What does that mean? He said, I'm not sure what it means. We had pre-specified a cut. 60% of the patients in this study came from the U.S. or Western Europe, and 40% came from Eastern Europe. And in the statistical plan for the study, we had specified that we were going to look at these two cohorts. And we actually succeeded, even though it was only 60% of the patients, in the Western Europe and U.S. patients. And we had failed in the Eastern European patients. He said, I'm not really sure. I said, well, are you confident in the SAP? And he said, that we've applied the SAP appropriately. And he said, I think we have, but that's a fair question. I said, don't we need to notify the board? Yes. I said, do we do that immediately? He said, I think so, but I'm not sure. I'm still working through it. So I said, well, I think this is only the third time we've had to have a phase 3, that we've had a phase 3 data set that the biostatisticians have run through and the clinicians have run through. I think we ought to get a new team and have them redo everything. So I said, that makes good sense. I'll tell the board that. And we did that. Obviously, highly confidential. It took us about a week to rerun those stats. And it confirmed that we had failed the study. So we convened the board, we made the announcement, the stock plummeted. It was really the first bad news the company had gotten on daptomycin since we'd licensed it in 97. And so I said to him at one point, I said, look, you may not need me. I mean, right, it's going to be a while now, I think, until we get daptomycin to the market, if we ever do. And I understand if we need to part ways. I'm not going to be a pain in the ass about this, but I also think I can help the organization. I've been in organizations that have failed in important drugs, and I can help the organization sort of work their way through this. If you'd like me to do that, I'm happy. I'm open to whatever. No, I'd like you to stay and work it through. So we announced it. The stock went from 35 to 17 within hours of the announcement. It ultimately got as low as 4. We had an ROW relationship with Gilead. They walked away from, they bought another antiviral company, HIV company, instead. And so they walked away from our relationship, and that, of course, was more bad news for the investors. We, Frank and I basically spent many hours with the data and developed a whole set of hypotheses. We weren't very big at the time. We were maybe 120, 125, 130 people. Most of the clinical group and the regulatory folks had written the drug off. Frank had not, but he couldn't understand why we could cure pneumonia with the same bacteria infecting rodents that we couldn't in humans. So we poured through the data, and our initial hypothesis is treatment differences between Western Europe and Eastern Europe, or Western world and Eastern Europe. So we cut the data in lots of different ways, trying to figure out if we could get any insight there. And what we found was that, in fact, there was a treatment difference. In the U.S. and Western Europe, standard of care was you present with pneumonia, you immediately get prescribed a broad-spectrum long-acting antibiotic. In this trial, almost everybody got either ceftriaxone or Levaquin. But in Eastern Europe, if you're a clinical trial candidate, you don't get prescribed a drug until you enter the trial. So they got their first dose 24 hours later relative to presentation than Western Europe and U.S. patients. And Frank, of course, he knew a lot about this, and I'm like, so if that's the only difference, it means... he said, I'm just not convinced that could be the difference. I said, what could... We went back and forth a lot. We designed a whole bunch of experiments. We brought in all kinds of experts, pulmonary experts, pulmonary infectious disease specialists, displayed all the data, and we developed all these hypotheses, and they just couldn't believe that that one difference was significant. So we said, well, could the drug not be working? So we re-ran it with different rodent models. We reran some. We were running out of money, by the way. We had $225 million of debt. We had $165 million of cash. We had no revenue, no royalty income, nothing. We reran in different rodent models what some might say are more classic rodent models of pneumonia, and the drug failed. So now we had another bit of data, even though they had succeeded in the other rodent models. So we continued this conversation with the experts and so forth, and he designed a bunch of experiments, and ultimately, around about May of that year, we proved that when you administer daptomycin intravenously, you basically, obviously, are delivering the drug through the bloodstream, but in community-acquired pneumonia, you inhale the bacteria that caused the problem, and they lodge outside of the lungs and infect in. If you seed the lungs from the bloodstream, like with hospital-acquired pneumonia, the bacteria get lodged interior to the lung and infect out. Turns out, daptomycin binds with surfactant. Surfactant is a proteinaceous material that covers the lung and allows for the gas exchange, CO2 and O2. And so what we were doing was administering a placebo because there was no daptomycin available to kill the bacteria, which were right under that layer of surfactant. So we ran, in the post-antibiotic era, the first ever placebo-controlled pneumonia study, what we proved was a single dose of a broad-spectrum long-acting antibiotic cures CAP. We put all this data together, and we went to the FDA, and the drug still had terrific results in skin. It had an incredibly potent activity against MRSA, which was becoming a huge problem. And we started to engage with the FDA about, there was no other infectious disease really that we could do a phase 3 on in any precedent way, meaning no one had ever done one where it's only gram-positive bugs. because that's all the spectrum that this drug had. It didn't cover gram negatives. And gram-positive infections are ubiquitous in skin, and Streptococcus pneumonia is the most common gram-positive infection. So we can treat those patients theoretically. And the FDA said, well, you know, this is precedent-setting, but they were very impressed with the science and the thoroughness with which we did this. And what happened that summer as we were engaged in these conversations with the agency is Hershey Hospital in Pennsylvania, a patient who had a decubitus ulcer, a diabetic patient with a terrible skin, open skin wound, that was infected with both MRSA and vanc-resistant enterococci. Those bugs shared genetic material, and the VRE transferred to the MRSA, the vanc resistance gene, and the MRSA picked it up through a plasmid. And so we had our first confirmed vanc-resistant staph aureus. This was catastrophic. The CDC immediately called every manufacturer of drugs in the world and asked for samples to see what would kill MRSA. Cubicin killed MRSA, great. We had been in conversations as well in parallel about running, after the first approval, running an infective endocarditis study. In the pre-antibiotic era, if you got staph in your bloodstream and you were over 55, 100% of the time you died. If you were under 55, you had a 1 in 20 chance of living, 5% chance of surviving. It is one of the worst manifestations of bacterial infection that can exist. No one had ever done a phase 3 because these are terribly sick, complex patients. You get bacterial vegetations on the heart. It's hard to get antibiotics into it. It's the academic experts said there's no way you can do this study. But the combination of MRSA and our willingness to try and undertake this study, and we had protocols in front of the FDA for the infective endocarditis study, bacteremia endocarditis, I think, and a very strong leader in Mark Goldberger, who ran the anti-infective division of the FDA at that time, allowed them to eventually, I think it was around July, they said, okay, given what you've proven in the science with the surfactant, we agree with you that you can use the 1.5 pneumonia studies as part of your safety database, because these patients got systemic exposure to your drug at the levels that you're looking for approval in. And the fact that it failed in pneumonia doesn't change the fact that if there were adverse events that would show up from this drug, these patients would get them. It'll be difficult to do the analysis because many adverse events associated with failed pneumonia treatment are serious. But if you're willing to undertake that, you can use that as safety data, and we will consider a single indication in skin. So I had to fire essentially the whole clinical and, except for one doc, Bob Arbeit, and regulatory group because they lost confidence in the drug. And I couldn't get them motivated to do it. The scientists in the lab did the work, not the clinical guys and so forth. So I fired all of them. We cobbled together some consultants and hired a couple of people, and we started working on the NDA. And we got the NDA together, and we filed it by year end. And much to everyone's surprise, Frank and I went back and forth a lot about, is this a priority review or not? Do we really need another skin drug? And the conventional wisdom was, no, we don't need another skin drug. You'll never get a priority review. But we believe that the MRSA, the potency of this agent, the rapid-cidal nature, its ability to actually kill a biofilm, which is a really happens in endocarditis. Bacteria metabolism changes when they get into a biofilm. And if you have a cell wall, they stop making cell walls. They stop dividing. If you have a biofilm, that's what's going on. So if your agent works by interrupting cell wall synthesis, which is how penicillin and virtually all the beta-lactams work, it won't work in a biofilm. Cubicin worked in a biofilm. We proved that. So we had all these things, and so I said, let's give it a shot. So he drafted, and he and I worked together on, a letter requesting priority approval, and they actually accepted it when we filed the NDA. So we had a PDUFA date in June of 2003. So, you know, we had now Dr. Arbeit and Frank, and we had a good microbiology team, and they were working on responding to the FDA questions. We hired a new head of BD in the summer of 2002. Turns out, his name is Oliver Fetzer. Turns out he was actually hired to be my competition to succeed Scott. I didn't know that at the time, but I knew we needed a new BD head. And so Oliver and I really focused a lot on trying to bring in additional assets. So we're going to build a commercial infrastructure. Nobody would license this drug at that stage. Everybody thought, best case, this is a $200 million drug. We did a deal in 2003 with Chiron for ROW rights, most of ROW, which was a little bit of a positive. We worked diligence on a bunch of different anti-infective assets, not just antibacterials, but antivirals as well, trying to bring them in that we could run through the commercial infrastructure and have something to develop. The development team was scared to death we're going to fire them all because we were starting the endocarditis study, but we built for more than that, and we had more capacity than we needed. We get to about, April or May, and I get this call from the division director at the FDA, who basically says, it was early in the days of electronic filing, so we'd filed electronically, and the FDA had a software program that sat on top of these electronic files, which basically, called Jump, which basically allowed them to do their own analysis, right? They could go into the core data and do, if they, they could make their own judgments about whether a patient was evaluable or not evaluable, et cetera, and recut the data. They couldn't make it work on our data set. So we said, oh, let's see what we can do. And then we went back and forth with them, and we had a young man that we hired into Oliver's group in BD who was an ER doc, engineer, an IP expert, just a brilliant guy named Praveen Turpinetti. And he basically bought Jump, and he said, I can make it work. So we said to the FDA, look, we've got this guy. How about if we send him down there?
How does he know he can make it work?
We've got copies of the electronic file.
So he's been working.
He bought the software. Mm-hmm. He installed it on his own computer, installed the NDA, and he said, I can cut the data with this, but it's not obvious how you do it. So, based on my training at Seneca, I wouldn't even have considered this possible, but it was an existential threat. The FDA was basically saying, you're going to have to pull this file, or we're going to say no, and you're going to have to redo it and refile it, because we can't do our work. So we said, let's try something else first. And the woman who worked for Mark, who ran this group, Janice Sereth, was also very courageous and very bold. And I said, Janice, this is way out of whack, but we've got a young man here. Here's his background. I sent him the CV. He can make this work. He's also trained as an MD. So how about if we have him come down and work with your project team and see if we can, give us a couple of weeks, just see if we can do this. Okay, fine. We don't have the PDUFA date until June. That's fine. So Praveen goes down to Washington, and it works. And he can sit with the medical reviewer, he can sit with the toxicology guys, and he can say, okay, tell me what question you have. I can write the program on Jump to pull that data, and you can do your analysis. And it worked. So second week of June, PDUFA date is approaching, and we get the official letter from the FDA that there's been a major amendment to the filing, which is this Jump, it's code for the Jump issue, and so they're going to push the PDUFA date 3 months. Very unusual at the time in 2003. It became very common, but it's very unusual at the time. And, oh, by the way, fall of 2002, we submit the NDA on like December 19th. On December, must have been 27th or 8th, I'm home with my family, and Scott lived in the same, or in the next town over. He said, Mike, can you come over? And so I went over to his house, and he said, Mike, I've been diagnosed with head and neck cancer. And so I'd been raising with him in that fall that, you know, I was getting to a point where I felt comfortable that we should maybe effect a transition. He said, we have to accelerate this. So here's my plan. He laid out the plan. And so he introduced the subject to the December board meeting, to the board in January. In February, we put our press release at the annual meeting in June. Mike's going to become the CEO. Scott's going to become the non-executive chair. Away we go. So, but then he had to be treated. So he was remarkably strong, and throughout this whole period, he showed up a lot at work. But he we couldn't count on him, so I was essentially running the company from that point forward. So we get to June now, and just the PDUFA date is after the annual meeting, so I'm now officially the CEO within a week.
My question is this is happening, you're not even reflecting on this at this point, it's just you.
I've got to go.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
I got to go. Yeah. It's existential for the company. And frankly, I was very convinced that this was a drug that needed to get into commercial use, so they could do stuff that other drugs just couldn't do. And Frank predicted the problem with MRSA, and I believe, I mean, he showed me the data that supported his prediction, and most people weren't predicting that it was going to be as becoming a bigger problem as it did, but I believed him, and so we were off and running. This is critical for human health.
And people at FDA had the same?
Mark and Janice had the same view, and I think that's what encouraged them to be as bold as they were. So I become the CEO on whatever, January or June 4th or 5th at the annual meeting, and on June 10th I announce, the dates might not be accurate, but in the right ballpark, it was within a week, that we've got this major amendment. It's going to take 3 more months. So, oh my God, there was a, we had a conference call, our biggest shareholder, which was at the time, which was Deerfield. Top three, anyways. Get off, Frank and I on the conference call, answer all the questions as best we can. Some we just can't answer. We get down the call about 7:30 that night, and immediately my phone rings, and it's the lead guy, the PM at Deerfield. So the word on the street is you're either a liar or incompetent. Which is it? You and Tally on the phone, 8 o'clock tomorrow morning. So we get on the phone with him. He repeats this with, you know, half a dozen of his colleagues from Deerfield. So the word on the street, Bonnie, is you're either a liar or incompetent. Which is it? And I said, well, I guess I would, if given that choice, I guess I'd rather be a liar because I can affect that. Incompetence, you probably can't overcome, right? So we took him through everything. And I at some point I just said, well, we're done, Bob. I've told you everything I'm going to tell you, everything that's in the public domain. You can believe it or not, but this is all there is to say. And, you know, we worked through the over the summer with the FDA. Our new PDUFA date was September 12th. That was the first day of ICAC, which is our big infectious disease meeting. And on the Friday before the 11th, I think it was. Maybe it was. No. Yeah, I think it was the 11th. Whatever it was. No, it was September 12th was the Friday because it was my sister's birthday. And ICAC started on the 13th. 6 o'clock, I get a fax and a phone call simultaneously from Janice, the division director, saying, congratulations, Cubicin's approved, here's the label, etc. And we turned on a dime and we you know, were able to put Cubicin up, but we had no money, so we couldn't build any inventory. We couldn't launch. So we then cranked up the production. We went out and raised some money. We raised, I don't know, I think $82 million that year. In a secondary offering to get us through the commercial build and the pharmacovigilance and all the things you have to have if you go to market.
Did you feel good about doing that at that time? You've got an approved drug.
Once we had the approved drug, yeah. I felt very confident doing that. And I was more bullish about the possibility for the drug financially than anybody on the street was. But I have in the garage downstairs the banker, silly stuff, staff busters, I think they you know, the gold ghostbusters, they had the CFO and me and the IR person in those heads superimposed. We convinced people that there was an opportunity for this drug. We set $500 million peak at that point. I think people were highly skeptical, but we had a pretty successful deal. It was oversubscribed. I forget how much, what we were trading at, $10 or $11, something like that, a share. And that gave us enough money to be able to build the inventory and to pay the salespeople. We hired some of the senior salespeople and made contingent offers to everybody else. So now we could fulfill those contingent offers. We had the training program ready to go. We launched on November 3rd of 2003. And by the end of 2004, we had the most successful IV antibiotic launch, at least for that period of time in history. We had initiated the endocarditis bacteremia study. We didn't have any data from that. It was still accruing at that point, but we had figured out how to put a protocol together that the FDA said could, if successful, would allow them to write a label. We had the sites up and running. We were dosing at a 50% higher dose. And remember, this is a drug that Eli Lilly put on the shelf for tox problems, but we figured that out. And, you know, so we launched with about, I would say, a half. The head of commercial, Greg Stay, at the time would say a third of the number of people that the models told us we needed to have. But I said, we can't afford to take on 225 people. We got to do this with fewer people. So we were very rigorous about cutting the hospitals based on the use of vancomycin and where the bugs were. And we put 75 salespeople in the field. Because we didn't have much inventory, we decided we couldn't afford to stock the wholesalers. And our CFO at the time, David McGurr, was a Wall Street CFO, not a industry CFO. And he was rightly so concerned, based on everything he'd heard and read and learned, about revenue recognition if you stock the wholesalers anyway. So we decided, we set up again a unique distribution system. We hired a small company that was a sub of one of the big wholesalers to be our outsourced warehouseman. And the way we did this is we had the hospitals could order cubes and vials the way they ordered every other drug. So it went to a wholesaler. And then we paid the wholesalers their 2% discount, essentially, although they never, we never shipped them product. But when we'd ship it from the warehouse, so the order would come into the wholesaler, they would split it off if it had the cubes and NDC. They'd send it over to our outsourced warehouseman. They would ship it directly to the hospital, but the billing would go through the original wholesaler. So the wholesaler, our receivables were with three major wholesalers, not thousands of hard-to-pay hospitals. They got their 2%, 30%, so they made money on it. It looked the same to the hospital, except when it came in a, you know, its own package instead of the big bins that they get from the wholesalers. But what it gave us, which we insisted upon but didn't realize the value of initially, was real-time data. So at the end of every day, this whole warehouseman that we hired would send us a tape, transmit us data that showed us who bought the drug yesterday. So when our salespeople woke up in the morning, they knew who of their accounts bought Cubicin yesterday. And no other pharmaceutical company has that insight into what's happening in a hospital. And that became a huge advantage. If somebody bought, the sales rep could go in and say, okay, what's going on? Is there a patient that you need this for? Is this just a stocking order, et cetera? We could discern patterns of orders. So if the pattern changed, either up or down, the sales rep could again go in and say, you have an MRSA outbreak locally. If it went down and said, is there a competitive threat here, or did you see some adverse events? What's happening here? And that level of market knowledge became an enormous competitive advantage. We did multiple analyses, probably cost us 75 basis points in the cost of goods in the gross to net calculation, but became apparent very soon that that was an inexpensive price to pay for the quality and timeliness of that data. Mm-hmm. We're at 3:15 and I'm okay. Worn out, so.
Okay, very good. Maybe at some other time we could take just a short period and finish up the story. Great stuff.
That drug, the last quarter before Merck bought us, closed on the deal, that drug did worldwide end-user sales a run rate of about $1.2 billion. It's the largest IV antibiotic ever. Twice failed.
And you didn't project anything close to that initially?
Initially, when I was doing my diligence, I told the board I thought it could be this is before I knew it failed in pneumonia. but I thought it could be a $700 to $800 million drug. And when we launched, we said publicly we thought it could be a 500.